You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, Dave Chadwick. Dave is the author of a terrific book called This Must Be the Place, How the U.S. Waged Germ Warfare in the Korean War and Denied It Ever Since. Dave Chadwick, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. I really enjoyed this book. The title is pretty clear, but what is the basic story that you're reporting here these many years after the fact?
It's an amazing story, really. One of the more amazing things about it is that Jack London, back in 1903, wrote a story called The Unparalleled Invasion, and I almost decided to call my book the same thing because he described a raid upon China where the powers, I'm not sure who he had bombing, doing the bombing, but they would bomb China with all sorts of insects. And this is exactly what the United States did during the Korean War when it got bogged down and couldn't seem to advance any further in 1952. The difference is that in Jack London's story, there were little glass containers that shattered when they hit the earth, but there were more advanced methods to carry the insects in the case of the U.S. bombing China and North Korea. The biggest piece of documentary evidence that really impressed me in my research that I did was the 38 confessions by U.S. airmen who had participated in dropping these insects. Their confessions were published in batches in the magazine People's China, which was the predecessor to Beijing Review. That's what the magazine was called in those days. And I was fortunate to have access to the University of Washington Library, which has a large collection of valuable manuscripts and so forth from the Far East, including the original issues of People's China that I could look at.
And these were, just to be clear, Dave, these were not killer insects that would devour Chinese soldiers, but rather insects that had been infected with deadly diseases by U.S. scientists, right?
Right. And most deadly of all was the same disease that caused the Black Plague in the Middle Ages. And in that time, they didn't realize that fleas played a key role. It wasn't until around 1900 that it was discovered the role that fleas had played in spreading the bubonic plague. Now they knew that when the U.S. used these insects.
So I think it's well established that the U.S. has had bioweapons laboratories and has infected insects with diseases and planned to use them as weapons and has used bioweaponry against Cuba, and the little ticks that brought us Lyme disease were probably a creation of a laboratory on Long Island and so forth. But where is the proof that disease-infected insects were dropped on North Korea or China?
Well, the biggest proof was finding all these insects, large quantities of them, and strange appearance of them in the middle of winter, and then, you know, just much larger quantities than they would ever have appeared naturally. I remember one attempt to dismiss the evidence. They said that somebody had made a claim that insects found all over the ground here were dropped by a U.S. plane, but they said that's merely a deduction from the fact that they found large numbers of insects anomalously on the snow over an area of 6 by 3 miles right after the plane went by. Well, I'm thinking it's a deduction, true, but it's a very good deduction, and it seems like there's no other explanation you could give for why they would suddenly appear. I know there was one story that peasants had found these large bags of bugs, bags of insects, and this one peasant thought that maybe the Chinese forces were distributing the bugs so they could blame the U.S., but this just is too hard to believe that this could have been done. If I could revert to these 38 confessions.
Sure.
This was the most impressive evidence in when they had exhibitions of evidence. People would see insects and so forth, but, they could have been faked or something. But these confessions were given in the person's own handwriting. There were recordings made of their voices. And then just the obvious sincerity of what they had to say. However, the standard explanation for all this was that these guys had been brainwashed, and this was some mysterious process that supposedly took place. where you could have your mind tampered with in such a way by various forms of torture and so forth that your mind would have been emptied of its real thoughts, and then some other thoughts could be stuck in there from outside. And like as in one of the pilots, when they came back, they all retracted their confessions, and a big point was made out of this too. But, you know, I think the confessions were when they were sincere, and then the confessions being retracted was just something they had to do to avoid getting punished. But one of them had this interesting statement. He said, this is the hardest thing I have to explain, that it was my words, but it was their thoughts. And he said, it seemed real to me, like the feelings, everything seemed real, and yet we knew it didn't happen. And this was supposed to be a real eyewitness testimony of having undergone brainwashing. But what turned out is that the Chinese had what they called a lenient treatment policy. I had an interview that I was lucky enough to get with one of the POWs who, at the end of the Korean War, decided to stay in China. His name was Jim Veneris. And when he was captured, he didn't know what was going to happen. And this big, tall guy, he said he spoke good English. He told him, sit down. He said, would you like a cigarette? And then he told Veneris, we have a lenient treatment policy. We won't harm you. And at the end of the war, we'll return you to your loved ones. And there's also testimony of Japanese prisoners when they first started out in the war, you know, this earlier war with Japan. First thing they had to do was chop the heads off some Chinese prisoners. And they didn't expect to be treated well at all, but even in spite of all those things they had done, they were treated well, too. So my belief is that the reason why these people confessed, the first ones who confessed, they had guilty consciences for having done what they did. And they even said that one of them was ready to confess as soon as he had a chance. There were some that were stubborn and didn't want to confess, but they got implicated by the confessions of others. And so I think the 38 confessions are the best evidence we have. I almost thought of putting them as an appendix in my book because they make up, but it would be just a little bit prohibitive, the length and so forth. But it would be nice if they could all be published again so people could evaluate it.
Well, we will link to those that are available from TalkNationRadio.org with this show. Dave Chaddick, we today throw around the term brainwashing to refer to anyone who's been persuaded of some delusion. But this was a term that really came into use during the war in Korea, and it meant something much more significant, though in fact not not real. Is that right? Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, the term was not used at all until this man who really had contacts with the CIA, but he kept them hidden, and he wrote a couple of books about brainwashing. One of them is called Brainwashing. And he tried to explain it. Either one explanation he had was that some kind of superior form of hypnotism might have been used, and another explanation he thought it might have had something to do with the Pavlov's conditioned reflexes, that somehow you could just condition people to say whatever you wanted them to say. But the explanations kind of fall flat. And one of my favorite ways of getting into what actually happened is the testimony of one of the American POWs named Morris Wills in his book called Turncoat. And he explained that there was no real massive torture or any kind of thing. There was no electrodes attached to his brain. He said it was just, he used the term a long, horrible process, but he says the process was simply being convinced step by step, idea by idea, until you came to believe what the person who was trying to persuade you of, you know, that he just won the battle to persuade you. And I remember one of the examples they used, that they tried to show how the U.S. prisoners have been brainwashed, because the Chinese would show them these maps that showed U.S. air bases all over the world. And they said but the U.S. prisoners didn't realize that, oh, these were not warlike. They were just means of bringing about peace. But it seemed to be, it didn't seem, well, one of the best books was by Eleutherius Winans. He's got a strange name. He wrote a book called The Communist Persuasion. And he said you should never argue with a communist because it's like we have a mishmash of ideas that are sort of confused, and we think one thing one time and another thing another time. You come up against this steel-like conviction. It's kind of like a razor blade versus a bowl of Jell-O. And what happens is you're going to lose your cherished ideas, and you should never get into a battle with a communist because you don't want to lose those ideas that you really cherish. It's kind of like what they once said about Socrates, that somehow he was making the worse appear the better cause. So to me, it seemed like brainwashing was simply, like we use the term today, we don't necessarily no longer associate it with some kind of weird process where we've been tortured.
Yeah,
the mind has been completely eliminated and a new mind is given us and so forth. It's
just
a question that we haven't had access to the truth. We've been told all a bunch of lies. And so I knew there was some brainwashing going on somewhere because either the pilots and so forth had been brainwashed or else we've been brainwashed into thinking that these pilots were telling a lie, and that's what I think has happened. I agree that it's one of the greatest hoaxes of all time, as it's been called. But the hoax is not that the U.S. Was accused of doing something it didn't do, but that we've been brainwashed into thinking the U.S. did not do it. So,
but again, this term brainwashing, as you have just explained very well, it came down to actually persuading people to tell the truth and make confessions. But in fact, the idea that the public has through the book and the movies, The Manchurian Candidate, for example, is of something much more powerful and sinister, and being able to control a human being like a robot and have them confess to things that never happened at all. And yet, these pilots, as you say, when they got back to the United States, did recant their confessions, which people take as very serious evidence against them. But in fact, you've found evidence that pilots and others in the military were kept quiet by various means. How was that done? How else has this story been kept hidden?
Yeah, right. Well, the first thing was that at the very beginning, they actually tried to keep what the pilots were doing secret from the pilots themselves. They would ask them, they would say, now don't worry about, you're going to fly low, but don't worry about explosions because these bombs are going to be duds. And just we want to know where you drop your duds. And but they finally figured out there was something going on, and they have interesting stories about the first day that they found out what they were actually doing. And it just really shocked them when they really learned what they were up to. And so then they just had to be kept pledged to secrecy after that. And in fact, they couldn't even use the word germ anywhere in the airbase or the term bacteria. They wanted to keep this a big secret. Some of the revelations, one of the confessions, even has the testimony of a General Jerome in May of 1952 when they had a big staff meeting, and he explained that we're pretty sure the enemy's aware of what we're doing, but the big thing we're trying to do is keep it in a secret from our own people. And they carried it to an extreme length. There was one soldier who sent a protest letter to his hometown newspaper protesting against the germ warfare. The letter was turned over to Army Intelligence, and he was sentenced to 20 years in jail. That was later reduced, but, I mean, started off being sentenced to 20 years. The funny thing about it is that if they were to punish these pilots for revealing the secret, then that would be they'd have to admit that they did it. So they were in a kind of a catch-22 situation if they were pilots when they came back. So it was kind of like they talked to them and private and told him, you know, look, I wouldn't try to keep up what you told the Chinese over there because anything you do in that regard will not be believed. And you'll just be, we'll just tell everybody you were brainwashed so bad that you haven't recovered yet. In fact, many of the returning POWs, because many of them had been visited by some of the germ warfare dropping pilots, and they were convinced that the germ warfare had happened also, so they had to be isolated from the American public when they returned, and they were accused of being mentally deranged, because one of the tests of being mentally deranged was whether you said something about you believed in germ warfare. Because, and then all these scholars that have just been, just one after another, been, in my words, brainwashed into believing that the whole thing was an absurd charge. There's a book that's available now called The Man Who Loved China by Simon Winchester, and it's about Joseph Needham, the China scholar, and he was also the leader of a international scientific commission that investigated the charges of germ warfare. And he claims that Winchester accuses Needham of being pitilessly duped by the Chinese in this scientific investigation, when actually it was a really good attempt to get at what was really going on.
We're speaking with Dave Chaddock, who's the author of This Must Be the Place, How the U.S. Waged Germ Warfare in the Korean War and Denied It Ever Since. Dave, what about U.S. government records? They have to have written something down. Many, many years have passed. We're supposed to have a transparent democracy. What, if anything, has come out?
I got the volume that came out many years later that covered this period, and there was only one reference that I could find in the whole big, giant volume there that had anything to do with germ warfare. And they ended up, they said there was a report of this, but it's obviously been something that didn't happen. They just kind of denied it. If I could say something about the denials of the captured Americans when they came back.
Yeah.
You know, because they've spent enormous amounts of effort trying to discredit the confessions of the 38 prisoners who confessed. For example, they said, they used un-American speeches, you know, like they would say things that only communists would say. And yet, when you examine these statements, I don't find any of this, very little stuff like this. There was one prisoner who did talk about U.S. imperialists, or he talked about Wall Street, which in those days, you don't usually, only communists would talk about Wall Street. But this guy had been captured by communists, and they were talking about Wall Street, and he kind of got convinced by them, and he might have said a few things that they would have. They would have said, but this is not the main. You don't find this being predominant in these confessions. He's the only guy that even mentioned Wall Street.
Right. So they pointed out that one mention of Wall Street as if the confessions had all been written by the Chinese.
Yeah. Right. And then if you examine the retractions are very, very, they're even harder to get a hold of than the confessions, because there's no conviction in them whatsoever. There's three or four of them that use the exact same words, and they say the only way we ever heard about germ warfare was when the other side talked to us about it, and also they said anything they said about germ warfare was an out and out lie, and every one of them used the phrase out and out lie. That was the only kind of lie they knew about. Not any kind of lie except an out and out
one. They were signing on to the same statement.
Right. So. It's amazing, really, that we've been misled so long about this.
And it's amazing to me that the primary public cover-up of the confessions was this fantastical science fiction idea of brainwashing that, you know, others, including the CIA, have pursued for decades. How could you do this? They wanted to be able to do this and given up. It can't be done. You can't control a person in that way. At least no one as far as we know, has figured it out yet. And yet we don't go back and say, well, then if they weren't brainwashed because that doesn't exist, then weren't they really confessing? And what were they confessing to? We don't have that sort of historical memory to go back after the fact and unless we read your book.
Yeah. The CIA, it's strange because it almost seems like at least some of the people in the CIA didn't really believe that we had used germ warfare. They really were sincerely trying to find out how to do it, so they could beat the Chinese at doing it. And
to do brainwashing.
Much of this Canadian doctor who subjected a whole lot of mostly young women to these electroshock treatments until he practically, the first step in brainwashing was supposed to be to clear the brain of your other thoughts. And he did a pretty good job of messing these women up and removing their brains of what they had in there so that some of them were unable to function afterwards. But as far as inserting new things in there, they didn't get that far. And it's just a terrible thing that happened with their experiments to try to produce brainwashing.
And so, assuming that the germ warfare did happen, which I am convinced of, in great part because of your book, and that the United States was dropping insects of various types with various diseases in China and North Korea, why didn't it work? And why should we be so upset about it? I mean, this was a war in which the United States dropped all kinds of weaponry on farms and villages and dams and families and killed millions of human beings. And very few of them, in fact, were killed with biological weapons. Why didn't it work? Why didn't it kill on the scale that it was supposed to? And why are we supposed to be so upset about it when the other weapons are just fine and legal and civilized?
Right. Well, the two parts to this question. The part about why we should be more upset about it has to do a little bit with Theodore Roseberry. He was somebody that worked on U.S. bacteriological warfare for many years. At Fort Detrick, he even admitted that the smell of evil hangs over. Kind of like you've got doctors are supposed to be helping people, they're supposed to be curing diseases, and yet they had to use medical science to spread bacteriological warfare. You have to use medical research to hurt people spread disease, and then also because it's something that's mass destructive on the level of like an atomic bomb. It's indiscriminate. It kills everybody. I mean, everybody, not just the soldiers or the ones you're fighting. And it was just I think that's why some of the pilots confessed, because they were just appalled at what they were doing. Why it didn't work is that the U.S. underestimated the ability of North Korea and China to fight back. There was a massive program of inoculations, you had to, in North Korea, for example, you'd meet a roadblock, and if you didn't have your statement of that you'd been vaccinated, they wouldn't let you proceed, and you had to get a vaccination right there on the spot if you didn't have your certificate. And in China, like people that were working with food or whatever, they had to get a quota. They had to kill a quota of 30 flies every day. And it's believed that by the end of this intense war on flies that they probably killed enough flies to fill 233 rail cars full of flies. Even years afterward, the people were reporting coming from China, they couldn't find any flies over there. But Harrison Salisbury... in 1972, he found 51 flies in 6 weeks, and I did a little better in 3 weeks. I found 49 of them in 1973. But I agree with the expedition of the concerned Asian scholars that visited about that time. Their statement was there are flies, but there are not very many, and it's because of this huge effort that had been made to just kill probably many of the insects that were killed were innocent insects that had, you know, they weren't carrying any disease, but they overdid it perhaps, but they sure wiped out a lot of the disease carrying ones.
Well, I'm not sure that I accept that the bombs were somehow less indiscriminate. I mean, even looking at targeted drone kills now and who they actually kill compared to who they're targeting, it looks completely as indiscriminate as poison gas. But setting that aside, the general assumption is that, in fact, biological weaponry is one of the bad weaponries, that it's unacceptably indiscriminate and evil and should be done away with. Why dredge this up now? Can it help, you know, finally put an end to the Korean War that's never really been ended? Or can it help the United States finally put an end to its biowarfare programs?
Well, I think the good thing about it, if the U.S. was to admit this, it's one of the main antagonisms that North Korea has. You have this country that did this and won't admit doing it. Their other big beef is that the U.S. actually started the war, even though the U.S. denies that as well. But if the U.S. would come clean and confess what it has done, that we could perhaps bring an end to this. We could definitely bring an end to this Korean War, which we should do.
With just a couple of minutes left, and we'll have to have you back on for this conversation, but most Americans have been convinced for decades, and were convinced in the time, that North Korea invaded South Korea unprovoked. What's the truth of the matter?
Yeah, and most recently, that opinion has been reaffirmed due to the revealing of some secret documents revealed by Yeltsin that have to do with plans by the North to start the war. My quarrel with that, though, is that they don't have any evidence that goes beyond 5 days before the war started. But during that time, we had a visit of Dulles, and we have testimony from people that defected to the North. We also have testimony from somebody that was a leading official of the South Korean regime when it was in between dictatorships, that when Dulles came to visit a few days before the start of the war, he told Syngman Rhee that the time is ripe. We want you to attack, but blame it on the other side. Give us about 3 weeks, and we'll bring in the United Nations. Well, it didn't quite work out that he got 3 weeks, because in 3 days, after he started the war, in 3 days, he practically lost the whole of Korea.
And is this...
We've been blaming that initial battle there is what happened, was the first blow in the war.
Something that I.F. Stone wrote about not long after it happened. We will have to have you back on for another conversation. We've been speaking with Dave Chadek, who is the author of this book. You should get it right now. It is called This Must Be the Place: How the U.S. Waged Germ Warfare in the Korean War and Denied It Ever Since. Dave, thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Well, thank you for having me there.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersnap.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Republican presidential candidates disagreed on many things, but when it came to the idea of raising the minimum wage, they were in concert. It would be a disaster, increase joblessness, and knock us out of international competition. Media usually present the issue as one of workers versus business, but that's not the whole story. We'll get a different angle from Holly Sklar of the national network called Business for a Fair Minimum Wage. Also on the show, transparency and accountability, principles we'd hope would be paramount in the workings of state governments. But a new assessment called the State Integrity Investigation shows they are actually in short supply. We'll learn the extent of the problem and what journalists can do about it from the investigation's project manager, reporter Nicholas Kuznets of the Center for Public Integrity. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press. The invitation for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to speak at the Center for American Progress, a Democratic Party-oriented think tank, was controversial, coming amid charges that the group had dampened criticism of Israel to placate funders. To its credit, the think tank allowed staffers to post afterwards a list of 10 falsehoods that Netanyahu told during his appearance. The New York Times took a different approach, relaying the prime minister's claims without question, even when Netanyahu himself urged listeners to check them out. The Times wrote, quote, "It's become an axiom that we are gobbling up land. We're not," Mr. Netanyahu said, asserting that no new settlements had been built in the past 20 years in Israel and that the expansions had not materially altered the map. "Google this," he implored the audience, close quote. The New York Times has more resources at its disposal than Google, but it's someplace to start. So what turns up? There's a Wikipedia article noting that while according to official Israeli policy, no new settlements were built, at least some 100 unauthorized outposts were established since 2002 with state funding, and the population growth of settlers did not diminish. There's a fact sheet from the Hunger Group Oxfam, produced for the 20th anniversary of the 1993 Oslo Accords between Israel and the PLO, that details the expansion of settlements in the decades that followed. Expanding Israeli settlements now have control over more than 42% of the land in the West Bank, it notes. And while demolition orders are sometimes issued, they are seldom enforced. The Center for American Progress's own 10 Falsehoods post shows up. It explains how the Israeli government allows new construction in the vicinity of older settlements to be defined as neighborhoods and outposts when they are in practice new settlements, sometimes on Palestinians' private land. And that last year, Netanyahu's government endorsed 13,851 new settlement housing units in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, four times the amount of previous years. Readers who followed Netanyahu's advice to turn to Google, then, would be much better informed than those who simply read the New York Times parroting his claims. The lead of Scott Pelley's November 8th 60 Minutes report on security clearances said it all. Quote, "The fugitive Edward Snowden, convicted spy Chelsea Manning, and mass murderer Aaron Alexis all had one thing in common, U.S. government security clearances, which they turned into weapons," close quote. How do you get Snowden, Manning, and the Washington Navy Yard spree shooter in the same category? By treating leaks to the press and a sawed-off shotgun as the same thing. It's a peculiar stance for a TV news magazine that prides itself on its tradition of investigative reporting to take, that getting information out to the public is a form of violence. It's also odd for journalists to describe Manning, because she was convicted under the Espionage Act, as a convicted spy. The law forbids giving an unauthorized person classified information. Language that was not meant to give the U.S. an official secrets act, but which has been treated as such by the Obama administration. Regardless of whether this is legal or constitutional, the act doesn't change the meaning of the word spy. Presumably, when 60 Minutes reporters get classified information from government officials, they don't say to their sources, "Thanks for spying for us." At one point, Pelley acknowledges that some believe that Snowden and Manning were right to expose what they saw as government abuses. But as Kevin Gustola noted for the blog Shadowproof, the show is presenting a national security state argument, doubtless encouraging an increasingly chilly climate for potential whistleblowers. Unfortunately, elite journalists all too often have a tendency to identify not with those who expose official secrets, but with those who persecute those who expose them. Epitomized by Time magazine's Michael Grunewald writing that he, quote, can't wait to write a defense of the drone strike that takes out Julian Assange, close quote. Or Meet the Press's David Gregory asking Glenn Greenwald why, since he aided and abetted Edward Snowden, he himself should not be charged with a crime. Well, finally, though, there are more subtle ways of siding with the secret keepers and against the revealers. New York Times reporter Charlie Savage told Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman November 4th not to blame Obama or Bush for the prosecution of whistleblowers, which is something that just happened. Quote, because of technology, it's impossible to hide who's in contact with whom anymore, and cases are viable to investigate now that weren't before. That's not something Obama did or Bush did. It's just the way it is in the 21st century, and investigative journalism is still grappling with the implications of that. Close quote. As Fair associate Norman Solomon wrote for Common Dreams, it's as if the president at the wheel has little choice but to follow the technological routes that have opened up for Big Brother. Quote, in effect, the message is that if you don't like mass surveillance and draconian measures to intimidate whistleblowers as well as journalists, your beef is really with technology, and good luck with pushing back against that. Close quote. It's true that refraining from using the tools of modern surveillance to wipe out investigative journalism requires a recognition that making public things government would rather keep secret can have a positive value. But if journalists don't acknowledge this, why should we expect the government to? You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Whether the federal minimum wage should be raised was the first question of the recent Republican presidential candidates' debate. Unsurprisingly, the responses ranged from no to hell no. But given a media environment in which some pundits claim that there is no wage too low to pay someone, it's significant that the question even came up. When you think of the fight to raise the minimum wage, you might think of fast food workers who've been at the forefront of the Fight for 15 movement that's put a higher wage on the agenda in places like Seattle and Los Angeles and here in New York. You don't most likely think of business owners, as media's standard presentation often pits business owners, with their eyes supposedly on profits, against workers looking to earn enough to live on. That's where my guest comes in. Holly Sklar is CEO of Business for a Fair Minimum Wage and author of, among other titles, Raise the Floor, Wages and Policies That Work for All of Us. She joins us now by phone from Boston. Welcome to Counterspin, Holly Sklar.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Well, support for raising the minimum wage is seen by some as a call for social policy to trump purely economic reasoning, as if economic policy were ever neutral vis-a-vis social goods. But put crudely, it's seen as workers' interests versus owners' interests. So the very existence of your group would seem to complicate that presentation of things.
Well, certainly, and that's what we intend. There's a big misunderstanding that there needs to be some kind of a split between business and workers on raising the minimum wage or on the economics of it. But in fact, we think, and we are a national network of business owners and executives and business alliances who do believe a fair minimum wage makes good business sense. That's what we're about.
Well, I don't think anyone truly believes that Walmart would have to go out of business if they paid workers more. It seems like more an ideological argument that if they can make a squillion dollars, then they're entitled to every penny. But the rhetoric often tells us that it's the smaller businesses that would suffer, that wouldn't be able to hire or wouldn't be able to grow. And that seems to be what you're countering fairly directly.
Yes, that in general, we know that it's absolutely the case that you cannot build a strong economy on a falling wage floor, and the minimum wage adjusted for the cost of living has fallen dramatically. At the federal level, $7.25 is actually lower, adjusted for inflation, than the minimum wage of 1950, and it's a third lower than 1968. And so you cannot build a strong economy, and you cannot really build a strong business for the long haul on falling real wages. Most businesses in the country are small businesses, and so by definition, most of our members are small businesses, although we have some very large businesses as well. And we have business alliances, for example, the Greater New York Chamber of Commerce, which represents about 30,000 business supports raising minimum wage. Small businesses understand very well that workers are also consumers. If there's not enough money in the wage base of the economy of the people that they're hoping will come in and buy their goods and services, they feel it every day. And they also feel very directly what it's like to have a worker who, if they're underpaid, if they're not really earning enough to even keep a roof overhead, put food on the table, buy the winter jacket of a growing kid, they're distracted by this financial stress that's continual. And so they believe very strongly that the workers should earn enough so that they can focus on the business, on the customer, and not be constantly worried about just how are they going to make ends meet, how are they going to make the rent, and so on.
Well, you've just talked about the history, and I think it's interesting. Donald Trump and his ilk seem to connect holding down wages to this idea of making America great again. And that's more than ironic, given the actual history.
Yeah, well, my point is that's a big myth that has been sold. I mean, if cutting wages and cutting benefits and cutting just this whole notion that the more you can squeeze out of the worker at the same time as in the giant corporation, not the small businesses, but in the bigger corporation, you go in the exact opposite way and you have more and more of the revenue of the company going to fewer and fewer hands at the top. You know, we've already tested that. That's my point. That model is delivering us worse economic growth. That model is giving us a shrinking middle class, and that model is what produced the greatest economic meltdown since the Great Depression. There's nothing theoretical about that. We have seen what this business model and this economic model produces, and it's terrible. It's terrible for workers, and it's also terrible for most businesses. The biggest thing businesses have complained about in recent years is that they're just not seeing enough consumer demand. They're not seeing enough consumer buying power. They need more. You know, you need people to buy what they're making in order to sustain the business and to grow the business. And there's obviously a direct connection, or I say obviously, but to folks like Donald Trump doesn't, you know, ideologically they don't want to see it as obvious. You need people to have enough wages to be able to buy what they need. And if you're going to have a growing middle class, you need people to be able to buy more than just the bare necessities, right? And that's what we've lost sight of.
And yet you can, you know, open any paper and find somebody saying, well, yes, you know, ideally workers might make more, but the tough reality is if companies raise wages, they won't, that will lead to joblessness, you know, that jobs will be destroyed. And they present studies and numbers and charts that seem to make that argument. Is it really something where the economics are debated or highly contentious of how this would work?
At our website, businessforafairminimumwage.org, is actually a research summary, the most rigorous research on whether the raising the minimum wage causes job loss, and it does not. In other words, if you look at all the actual minimum wage increases in recent decades, so not projecting forward and saying based on my particular, often ideological-driven economic assumptions going forward, but if I'm looking back and looking at actual minimum wage increases and not being simplistic and like saying, I'll just pretend that there wasn't an economic meltdown in 2008 when I'm looking at, you know, what's the consequence of the minimum wage, but factoring things out. Anyway, the point is that this rigorous research of actual minimum wage increases really does show that there is either no effect or a slightly positive effect, or in some cases slightly negative, but when you look at it overall, on balance, does not cause job loss. Just in the last year or two, the states that have raised their minimum wage are actually showing stronger job growth. Now, I'm saying that that's not one of these rigorous studies. There's a reason for this. There's this direct connection between you can't expect people to buy what's being produced by business to continue to buy that at that level or more if you're driving down wages. It doesn't work. And one of the ways that this was masked for a while was people were using their home equity, for example, going deeper into debt to try and get by when wages were going down to continue to maintain living standards. That masked it for a while, but as we know well, that doesn't last forever. And we saw the consequences in the economic meltdown.
Well, just finally making the argument that a higher minimum wage is good for business doesn't preclude the social justice argument that people simply deserve to be able to survive on their paycheck, does it?
No. If you work a full-time job, you shouldn't be earning a poverty wage. I mean, it's as simple as that. You know, you shouldn't be earning a poverty wage in general. But of course, if you work full-time, at the end of the month, it should add up to what you need to pay rent and the other basics that you have. And the other thing, if I could just add, because this is important as to why so many of our business people feel very strongly about this, is businesses that are using this better business model as one that invests in their workers, they really see things like stronger productivity, stronger customer service. They see dramatic reductions often in worker turnover. So there are all these factors that are also internal to the business that bring real improvements in just the way the business is operating. That really is important for your bottom line as well.
We've been speaking with Holly Sklar of Business for a Fair Minimum Wage. They're online at businessforafairminimumwage.org. Holly Sklar, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
As disaffection with federal government grows, people look more to state governments to make change in their lives. State governments are generally believed to be less removed and more responsive to regular people. If you want to keep believing that, you should on no account read the latest state integrity investigation from the Center for Public Integrity and Global Integrity. It grades state governments on criteria including electoral oversight, legislative accountability, lobbying disclosure, and public access to information. And the results are not good. Here to explain the findings and their meaning is Nicholas Kuznets, project manager and reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. He joins us by phone from D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Nicholas Kuznets.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, what, first of all, does the state integrity investigation seek to measure?
The project is measuring the systems that states have in place that are really meant to deter corruption or catch it when it occurs. So we're looking at accountability and transparency measures, both at the laws and at how those laws are implemented and enforced.
So it's not really a list of incidents of corruption. It's really about the systems that are there to deal with it.
That's right. It's not a measure of corruption. The last place state, which is Michigan, we're not saying Michigan is the most corrupt or that first place, Alaska, is the least corrupt. You know, it gets into the funding of ethics agencies and whether or not records requests are actually accepted and supplied in a timely fashion and without citizens having to pay exorbitant fees.
Well, so there are variations among states on several vectors, but overall the results were, I think terrible would be an appropriate word. I mean, broadly speaking, is it that laws exist about things like conflicts of interest, but they are flouted? What's going on, and what are some of the examples that illustrate the problem?
It's a combination of those, but I think one area to look at this is public access to information, which is one of the categories that we looked at, and that's really looking at open records laws, open meetings laws. And that was actually the worst performing category. So 44 states got failing grades there. And what you see there are that open records laws in most states have just been riddled with exemptions that have been sort of tacked on over the years. But more than that, it is the application. You know, agencies will deny requests without much explanation of why, or they'll delay requests or charge, as I said, huge fees. And when that happens, citizens really have little recourse other than going to the courts, which obviously is an expensive, time-consuming process. You know, there's no entities, for the most part, that are meant to oversee these laws. There are a few exceptions. Iowa has one of those bodies that is meant to mediate disputes. So that's an example. I mean, you see the same thing in ethics enforcement, where you may have an agency or a combination of agencies, but for the most part, they don't receive the funding they need to do their jobs. They don't necessarily have all the authority to issue sanctions and to have real teeth.
Well, and if people think, well, it's just state governments that's kind of small potatoes, that's just not true, is it?
Exactly. I mean, you mentioned that partisan gridlock in D.C. has made people turn more to local and state governments for solutions. And, you know, it's tons of money. I mean, more than $1 trillion, nearly $2 trillion that state governments are collecting and dispersing every year. And they're passing thousands of laws. In many ways, state government really has a greater impact on people's everyday lives than D.C.
Well, and you talk about public access or open access to information, and that seems to cut to the core of democratic participation. I mean, before you even can push for anything or reform anything, you have to know what's going on.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I think another common theme throughout many states, most states, have part-time legislatures. So you have lawmakers that for some or even most of the time are doctors, lawyers, farmers. And they have their own private interests as well. Now, a lot of states value this setup. They say that this brings real world experience. You know, it's not professional politicians. And there's truth to that. But it also brings the potential for conflicts of interest. For example, in Missouri, you have a lawmaker who introduced a bill to prohibit cities from banning plastic bags at grocery stores. It turns out he's also the director of the State Grocery Association. Now, that's no secret. It presents an obvious conflict of interest, and that's just one of many examples, both in Missouri and across many states.
Well, one of my favorites, if you will, was Idaho, which has a $50 cap on gifts to lawmakers. It has this law or this policy, but a lobbyist was able to spend more than $2,000 hosting a state senator and his wife at a golf tournament, and it was okay because the money wasn't spent in return for action on a particular bill. It sounds as though if you can't point to a specific quid pro quo that's labeled as such, it's okay to just be kind of steeped in influence. You know, it sounds like it's just kind of such a culture of conflict that it's hard to cite a particular incident.
That's right. I mean, a sort of a common bar when you look at lawmakers is, and this is just a theoretical situation, it's fine for a car dealer to introduce a bill that has to do with the taxes on car dealerships as long as it doesn't just affect his car dealership. If it's industry-wide, many states wouldn't view that as a conflict.
But I think many citizens absolutely would.
Exactly.
Well, I remember back in 1998, a story in American Journalism Review called Missing the Story at the State House. It was about the decline in State House reporting that accompanied the consolidation of the newspaper industry. And a Detroit news reporter, Jim Metzelfeld, told how state coverage was falling victim to cost cutting, in this case by Gannett, and that he was being told to do stories that were super short, 6 to 8 inches. And when he argued that it took more space to tell both sides of a complex issue, he said, they'd say, we don't have room for both sides. Pick one side. You know, I always remember that example. But ideally, journalism could play a role here in taking up some of the slack of the watchdog agencies. What gets in the way of that?
Well, I mean, that is the role that journalists should be playing, and that's why we did the report. Unfortunately, you have cuts across the country to state house reporting, newspapers just having to cut staff. And so there isn't that presence that there used to be. There aren't as many eyes in state houses watching legislation. And that's part of why we did the project, is to help provide this information to citizens and also to journalists.
States did do pretty well on some counts. What were those briefly?
There are two categories in particular where states scored pretty well on the budget process. whether citizens have access to the budget process, whether they have input, whether there are adequate checks and balances. And a majority of states actually got B's or better there. Another category is internal auditing. So for the most part, states have pretty good systems in place to kind of look at their own books and to make sure that agencies are not wasting money. So these are important aspects of government operation that there is good news on.
Well, this is the second time, I guess, that you've done this. What's the trajectory? Are things in general terms getting better or getting worse, did you find?
First of all, the scores aren't directly comparable. We did a number of changes to the project to improve it, to make it more rigorous. For example, we got rid of two categories. Redistricting, for example, takes place once every 10 years, so we didn't want to do that again. And we also added some questions here and there to address evolving issues like independent campaign spending. That said, there has seemed to be a trend in a number of states toward increasing secrecy. There have been reforms here and there, but the public records laws are getting older. And as that happens, exemptions seem to be tacked on, and agencies increasingly tend to use them rather than to provide records, but to block records.
Finally, one of your sources who works on state ethical issues had, you know, I think a very, maybe even the takeaway comment, which was, it's very, very difficult for legislatures to focus on these things and improve them because they don't want these laws. They don't want to enforce them, and they don't want to fund the people enforcing them. I mean, it really sounds like a system where lots of folks are benefiting except regular citizens.
There's definitely some difficult incentives built into it when you have people responsible for creating the laws that are going to oversee themselves. There isn't a lot of momentum often to make changes. And generally, you don't see big changes happening, with rare exception, without major scandals. You saw that in Virginia with former Governor Robert McDonnell being convicted. They passed some laws which advocates have said are somewhat limited, but nonetheless, they passed some real reform measures there on gifts and creating a new ethics commission there. But it often does take a big scandal.
Well, and I guess that kind of brings us back to journalists, because it's often reporters who do the digging that brings those things to light. So I guess that's part of the reason, as you've said, that you really hope that journalists will not just read this, but take it up and use it, right? Use this and carry the story forward.
We want to bring these issues to light, and we also want this to be a resource for people, for reporters across the country.
We've been speaking with Nicholas Kuznets of the Center for Public Integrity. You can check your state's report card on the State Integrity Investigation at their website, publicintegrity.org. Nicholas Kuznets, thank you very much for joining us on Counterspin.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, FAIR.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Who is trying to kill solar power in America? As energy activist Nancy LaPlaca reveals, state by state, fossil fuel companies are trying to stop competition from safe, renewable power. Then we look at developing court evidence in Canada that fracking for gas and oil is polluting drinking water. Veteran Canadian investigative journalist Andrew Nikiforuk fills in this key part of the shadows of fracking. We'll wind up with part of my ongoing conversation with permaculture guru Albert Bates. Why is the worst news more popular than the best solutions? I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock this week. In May of 2013, we asked energy activist Nancy LaPlaca why the sun-drenched state of Arizona burns so much coal. Nancy has moved to North Carolina, where she's helping uncover a national plot by big power companies to slow down solar power in America. Nancy, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, the cost of solar has fallen almost in half. It should be sweeping the United States. Is it?
It's kind of a complex story, and I would say yes and no. Solar has been growing at an exponential rate. It's been growing quickly across the United States, but unevenly. You'd be surprised that there's not much growth in certain really sunny states like New Mexico or Arizona, and then there's been a lot of growth in places like Massachusetts and New Jersey. The biggest thing that's coming up is that the 30% federal investment tax credit is going to expire at the end of 2016. And so all the solar analysts see a huge drop-off at the end of 2016. So the problem there, Alex, is that we don't have market certainty. And so when you have a business situation without certainty, you've got people who bail and you've got companies that go bankrupt because they don't have enough sales to keep things going.
So according to the Washington Post on March 7, 2015, big U.S. utilities are fighting a campaign against rooftop solar power. What is the story there?
Yeah, that's an interesting story, and that was an excellent article. And in a nutshell, the utilities are a unique group, a unique business in our society. In many states, they have monopolies. In other words, no one else can compete. They also have extremely high costs, and they're called fixed costs. So in other words, the cost to run a coal plant, to run a nuclear power plant, is very high. And so when you start bleeding sales, even a little bit of sales, a small drop in revenue, a small drop in sales, can equal a very large drop in profit because the utility first must cover its very high fixed costs to run the power plant, to pay the people, to buy the fuel, to pay for the emissions control, hopefully. To run the power plant is expensive, and so the utilities fear even a small drop in sales because when customers go to solar, those sales are lost permanently.
Yeah, I know they have to take into consideration their stock values. They take out bonds. They take out debt and loans to have these fuel plants that are slated to run until 2040 and beyond. But if they do that, Nancy, by that time the world climate will be ruined with no way to stop runaway climate change. I'm wondering, is there a solution to this mess? Nancy, do you think some grid giants could go bankrupt if they can't or won't transition to clean power?
Oh, yes, we could very easily see it. I mean, look at the coal industry, which has lost literally 90% of its value in the last couple of years. The coal industry is going bankrupt, has gone bankrupt. However, we're still burning coal in power plants. So those utilities, even though the owners of the coal mines may change, the utilities are still burning coal. And you bring up a very valid point. If indeed, for example, we don't have as much natural gas as the shale industry would like you to believe, we could end up with literally many, many tens and even hundreds of billions of dollars in what's called stranded assets. So an analogy, Alex, is what happened after Chernobyl when all of a sudden all those nuclear power plants that were being built came to a halt. Those assets were basically stranded. And so ratepayers paid for them quietly. Many folks didn't realize they were paying maybe, you know, 50 cents a month on their power bill for a nuclear power plant that never got built. But the possibility of stranded assets is very real. And if you look at folks like the carbon bubble folks, Carbon Tracker, who are talking about a carbon bubble, this is part of that. Those assets could be literally abandoned either because we realize that due to climate change, we can't burn that carbon because we run out of fuel, because the fuel becomes too expensive.
Well, in a way, I'd love to show my grandson, you see that monster power plant over there, it used to burn coal or oil or gas, and now it doesn't anymore because we've learned, but we'll see if that day comes. Let's get specific. Now, in North Carolina, the big power is Duke Energy. Duke brags they've got a $3 billion wind and solar division. Are they sincere about wanting to get off fossil fuels?
You know, this is an interesting story. Certainly not in North Carolina. Duke Energy buys solar plants all over the country. They own quite a few in Arizona and California and in other states. But here in North Carolina, their home state, their plan for clean energy is 4% by 2029. That's in 15 years. So in other words, Duke Energy only plans to be 4% clean energy by 2029. And that is just simply inadequate. The other irony is that Duke Energy engages in deals that are illegal here. And many of us believe and have good reason to believe that Duke Energy is behind the legislative and other regulatory efforts to stifle clean energy. So in other words, Duke Energy takes advantage of certain financial arrangements that are legal in other states, but they're making them illegal here in North Carolina, and that's why we in North Carolina are looking at kind of a very difficult solar future at the end of this year.
So what is going on with the solar situation in North Carolina?
Well, we're also kind of unique in that virtually all of our solar is wholesale. In other words, it's very large scale. And in fact, Duke Energy has taken half of the solar tax credits. Now, we still have right now, it's going to change at the end of the year in a few short months, a thriving solar industry where every dollar that was spent in solar tax credits, we had very generous state tax credits of 35%. In other words, if you invested a dollar in solar, you could write off 35% of that. That tax credit is going to end at the end of the year. Duke Energy took half of the $200 million total that was spent on those tax credits over the last 7 years. However, when you look at those tax credits, every dollar that came out of taxpayers' pockets returned $1.54 to the tax coffers. In other words, it was a net gain, so that every dollar citizens spent on tax breaks came back in property and other taxes $1.54. In addition, every dollar spent on taxes came back as 10 to 20 times that amount of economic activity. In other words, the citizens spend a dollar on a tax credit, but it ends up building $20 worth of solar. And that $20 worth of solar returns $1.54 to the tax coffers. So it was really very foolish for the state legislature to kill the extension of the state tax credit and also to kill this certain finance arrangement known as third-party solar, which would allow no-money-down solar. And one last thing about this third-party solar that's very interesting, Alex, is Duke Energy is right now in six states, and in five of the states that don't allow third-party sales, four of them are Duke Energy states. Florida's one, North Carolina, Kentucky, and Indiana. So I think we could say that Duke Energy is working actively to stop this very successful financing mechanism that is responsible for at least 80% of the solar that's been built in the country.
And I know that kind of financing and other plans are available in Europe, and it's flourishing there because of it. Well, look, it seems like the American states with the most sun, as you say, have some of the worst records for solar power. Take Florida. How are they doing?
Yeah, that's a great question, Alex. Florida is a very interesting state. They're 61% gas, natural gas. They're 23% coal, and they're 12% nuclear, and they have a negligible amount of solar. The reason they don't have much solar is because this financing arrangement called third-party solar, where basically you can build solar for no money down, that is illegal in Florida. There's a huge battle going on right now in Florida with a ballot initiative that would allow this, and then the utilities, a utility-backed group, went and filed their own initiative. So it's sort of a battle of the initiative, because if you can create doubt and confusion, you can at least prevent the other side from winning. But Florida really is a sad case, because the Sunshine State has very little solar.
That is ironic. And after we talked a couple of years ago, how is solar power doing in Arizona?
Arizona is another interesting case, Alex. Arizona is now at about 5% solar and about 40% coal. And they continue to operate some of the dirtiest, oldest coal plants in the United States, which is really sad, because they could easily be replaced with solar. I hear from my solar developer friends in Arizona that you could install utility-scale solar for 6 cents a kilowatt hour. And really, that's way cheaper than you could do it on the East Coast here in North Carolina. And the reason that they don't really, Alex, is because they can generate coal, fired electricity, from a dirty power plant for 3 cents. They don't pay that 17 to 27 cents in health and environmental damages. Those just get dumped on us. They don't really pay the cost of coal ash, mercury, acid rain, you know, asthma, lost work days, et cetera. All they do is generate that coal kilowatt hour for 3 cents, and they do have other expenses, sell it for 11 or 12 cents, and make a profit. They don't want to go solar because, frankly, that means someone else gets the business. And in Salt River Project territory, they added a $50 a month fee to anyone who puts solar up on their roof. And so basically solar installations in that utility's area, and they have about 1 million customers, went down 90%. So in the world of solar, I'd say Arizona is, frankly, I'm sorry to say, something of a laughingstock. It's the sunniest place in the country, in the world, that is literally killing solar.
That's amazing. So if I put solar panels up on my roof and I want to hook into the grid and sell it to the utility, they're going to charge me an extra $50 a month?
Yes, in Salt River Project territory, yes, that's exactly what they're going to do.
That's outrageous. So what is going on with solar regulations in the U.S. Northeast?
The Northeast is interesting because that's what's called a deregulated market, Alex. And so in a regulated market, a utility like Duke Energy would go to the Utilities Commission and say, hey, we want to build a power plant. We want to build a gas plant. We want to build a nuclear plant. So give us the okay, and then we'll come back later and we'll give the ratepayers the bill. Well, in these deregulated markets, it's very different. You bid power in to an open market where the cost of power fluctuates daily. The reason that solar is flourishing in the Northeast is because you have some very forward-thinking utilities commissions that have given extra value to solar, or they've allowed certain types of solar. For example, one of the real no-brainers that hasn't gone anywhere yet but will is this idea of community solar. So community solar means I have too many trees in my house. I can't put up solar. But maybe me and 20 other people could go pay for a solar array, you know, 2 miles away in a nice, big, sunny, open field. And we would own it, and that's called community solar. States like Minnesota, Massachusetts, they're allowing community solar, and so that is flourishing. New York has some excellent solar policies. So does New Jersey, Massachusetts, Vermont. And so for that reason, solar is actually doing far better up there than it is in many of the sunny southwestern states right now. It's odd. The other interesting thing that's happening up in the Northeast is what's called demand response, which is sort of energy efficiency on steroids, where you could ask large energy users like Costco or Walmart to cut their energy use and pay them. That has been flourishing in that market, which is allowing utilities to burn less coal and gas. But they're trying to kill it because energy efficiency is undercutting nuclear and gas. And so, again, if these utilities can't sell enough power, they start to go in the red. So they don't want more energy efficiency.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest energy activist Nancy LaPlaca. We're talking about kind of a plot by big power corporations against solar power. So, Nancy, what are the institutions and deep lobby groups fighting solar power in America?
Well, of course, there's the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, it's called. There are the Koch brothers. There is the Edison Electric Institute, which is a nonprofit trade group that represents the investor-owned utilities. There are various trade groups that represent the natural gas industry, the coal industry. Basically, it's the fossil fuel companies and the electric utilities, and they are working to stop clean energy. And the Koch brothers, of course, are part of that. There's a lot of good work being done out there by Common Cause, by the Energy and Policy Institute, by Media Matters for America, by lots of good nonprofits that are looking at the connections and seeing where these, what we call astroturf groups, are getting their money to fight solar.
Nancy, talk to us about the role of the public utilities commissions that you mentioned in the struggle for solar. And can citizens directly affect those commissions, or are they captured by these grid power corporations?
You know, that's a lot of the crux of the matter. Most states, the governor appoints the utilities commissioners. In most states, the utilities are very, very big campaign cash contributors. So if you look at North Carolina, our governor, Pat McCrory, worked for Duke Energy for over 25 years. The Senate Majority Leader, Mike Hager, who helped kill solar, he worked for Duke Energy for many years. So you see this unholy alliance. In Arizona, Arizona Public Service Company, it will not deny it, and there's good evidence that they spent $3.2 million electing friendly commissioners. So some states, most states, commissioners are appointed by the governor, who unfortunately generally is tied up with campaign cash to the utilities. And then in the few states where they're elected, there's 13 states where they're elected, the utilities jump in and spend a lot of money. And so unfortunately, you've got a situation where these agencies are kind of secret. People don't even know about them. If you look at North Carolina and you consider that this group of seven commissioners, they are making decisions worth billions and billions and billions of dollars, tens of billions, even hundreds of billions over years. And yet you can't even get on the phone and listen to a hearing. You have to go there in person. You can't get on your computer and listen to what's going on. You have to go there in person. And so all we can do, groups like us, is shine a light, because as we know, sunshine is the best disinfectant. And so with an era of Citizens United, it's difficult, but you know, there are many of us out there working to show that solar isn't dying because it doesn't work. It's struggling because the utilities and their allies are spending lots of money to hold it down.
Nancy, we know that in Europe, Asia, and even Middle East oil-producing countries, they're investing heavily in solar power. I'm worried about what happens to America when climate change becomes so obvious that carbon taxes or outright bans on dirty fuels like coal finally arrive in the United States. What happens to a country that doubles down on the energy sources of the past?
That's a question I've thought about a lot, Alex. And my hope is that money that we've, you know, thrown down the drain, if we end up with stranded assets, all these pipelines, natural gas pipelines, all these power plants that we're not going to be able to use, coal plants, what will happen, I hope, is there's enough money left in the world and enough smart people to figure out the financing mechanisms that we can invest directly in our own clean energy. I believe, and the groups I work with, NC Warren and Climate Voices, in the democratization of electricity. And so my hope is that there are smart people out there who will make it happen and who will, for example, a green energy bank. I understand we're the only modern country that doesn't have a green energy bank, where you have a way for clean energy developers to borrow money at low interest. For example, there's a thing called the Master Limited Partnership. The shale oil industry has benefited greatly, tar sands, shale gas, oil industry, gas industry, and yet solar and wind are cut out. And so we're missing these huge pools of money that are available to the dirty energy providers, that are not available to the clean energy providers. And that is my hope, Alex, that there's enough of us who work on this that we keep these ideas going and that we all recognize that it's about the financing. And so once we pivot, we hopefully can put these processes and rules and financial arrangements in place that allow clean energy to grow quickly.
Tell us just briefly about the organizations you work with, North Carolina Warren and Climate Voices, and maybe give us a couple of places where we could go to find out more about the solar power story.
Well, thanks, Alex. Yeah, it's NC Warren, and that stands for North Carolina Warren, www.ncwarn.org, and also climatevoicesus.org, not Climate Voices, but climatevoicesus.org. And basically, we are motivated by we want a cleaner, greener world. We want clean electricity. We're very concerned about climate change. We're opposing Duke Energy's huge natural gas push. We are working with coal ash impacted communities because you probably heard that North Carolina had a huge coal ash spill. We have 150 million tons of coal ash in this state. We have 32 coal ash ponds with no lining, no groundwater monitoring. We're working on helping those communities. And we're helping to provide what's called solarized programs, where you bulk buy solar for communities that want to put up solar.
We've been talking with energy activist Nancy LaPlaca. You can find links to everything we've talked about in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much, Nancy.
Thank you, Alex. My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock, covering what the mainstream media leaves out. We are often ahead of breaking news. On September 30th, I interviewed Neela Banerjee from Inside Climate News about their investigation into ExxonMobil. That company was warned by their own scientists, starting in the 1970s, that their products would generate dangerous climate change. In the 1990s, Exxon funded groups specializing in sowing doubt or outright denial of climate change. Now, 2 months later, the Attorney General of the state of New York is investigating ExxonMobil. The state wants to know if the world's largest oil and gas company misled the public and shareholders. You heard it here first. President Obama killed off the Keystone Pipeline project, which hoped to bring dirty tar sands oil south to American refineries on the Gulf of Mexico. Obama actually spoke these words, which have been a theme on Radio EcoShock for almost a decade.
Because ultimately, if we're going to prevent large parts of this earth from becoming not only inhospitable, but uninhabitable in our lifetimes, we're going to have to keep some fossil fuels in the ground rather than burn them and release more dangerous pollution into the sky.
It's another nail in the collapsing tar sands project, but fracking in Western Canada continues at a mad rate, causing earthquakes and widespread pollution of water resources. Let's reach out to the best reporter on the case. Calgary, Alberta is the headquarters of Canada's boom and bust oil and gas industry, including the infamous tar sands and fracking. It takes guts to live there doing exposés on the damage done. That's what investigative journalist and author Andrew Nikiforuk did for the past 25 years, and he's still at it. His latest book is Slick Water, Fracking, and One Insider's Stand Against the World's Most Powerful Industry. Andrew Nikiforuk, I've been reading and admiring your work for years. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alex.
Now, on this program, I've covered fracking in Pennsylvania, New York State, Montana, California, but I don't know much about fracking in my own country, in Canada. But just before we go there, I'd like to briefly talk about the oil patch, the Canadian tar sands. Can we get a quick update from you on what's happening there?
Well, with the fall in oil prices, there's a rather dramatic shakeup going on in places like Fort McMurray and also in the offices of some of the major oil and gas companies in Calgary. Everyone thought that the boom would never end, and everyone thought the price of oil would just get higher. And, of course, none of that has turned out to be true. And the markets for really heavy junk crude like bitumen seem to be declining, not growing. The economic fallout in China, you know, is another warning signal to this industry that the demand that everyone thought would be there for bitumen is simply shrinking. And then when you add all of the concerns about carbon liabilities and carbon emissions, the tar sands might not have the long life that certainly the Alberta government and the industry hoped it would.
Yeah, there's been 54,000 layoffs, I read just the other day, in Alberta and more in Saskatchewan. Shell just abandoned a $2 billion project that they had going. It's really hard to predict where this is going to go.
And there are lots of companies in the United States, too, that are fracking in the Bakken and elsewhere, and they've all declared bankruptcy or posting incredible write-downs. This is a major dramatic shift, and what it will mean in the end is, well, more volatile oil prices for sure, I would think, but also that, you know, the industry is being given a very strong message that it is a dying industry, not a growing one.
And then we have Canada's top tar sands salesman and the anti-climate activist, Prime Minister Stephen Harper. What does his loss in October in the election just held, what does that mean for Canada's role now?
Well, hopefully it means a different role. I mean, Harper was, again, a great promoter of pipelines and a great promoter of exporting bitumen, which if you take all the climate scientists in the country and put them together, they'd say, look, this is not something, this product is too dirty for us to export, and we really need a program to get off bitumen. And it might be a 30 or 40 year program to do that. And hopefully with Trudeau, we might begin to see a recognition of the real economic and environmental liabilities associated with tar sands and any expansion of the tar sands. So you can't really address climate change and approve pipelines at the same time. It's craziness.
You know, along those lines, in 2012, you wrote a really unusual book titled The Energy of Slaves, Oil, and the New Servitude. Could you just give us a snapshot of what your argument was there?
Well, it was a philosophical book really looking at why we use energy the way we do and how high energy consumption has really changed modern life. It's very much responsible for our obsession with quantity of stuff, our obsession with speed, our obsession with the concentration of companies and the concentration of governments. Has changed the very nature of what it means to be human. And so the book basically asks the question, well, you know, how do we change that? Now, the cheap energy has been used to create this incredibly complex civilization. And now that cheap hydrocarbons are on their way out, and we're only left with extreme and difficult stuff, and green and renewable energy, which also comes with its own unique set of challenges and problems and lower energy returns, then where do we go? So it was a really philosophical look at those questions.
Okay, let's get to your new book. Is there a lot of fracking in Canada, and where is it mainly located?
Oh, Alex, there's a monstrous amount of fracking taking place in Canada, and it's an issue that most Canadians are not aware of. So there's an enormous amount of fracking taking place in northern British Columbia. In fact, some of the world's largest fracks have taken there, and the fracking of shale basins there has caused hundreds and hundreds of earthquakes. Same thing in Alberta. We have an enormous amount of fracking has taken place in the province. It used to be largely vertical fracks, but in the last 10 years, we've seen a lot of fracking of horizontal well bores. particularly along the eastern slopes of the Rockies, where companies have been chasing after tight oil deposits similar to the Bakken in North Dakota. And there again, the fracking has created a number of problems, everything from gas migration to groundwater contamination to really significant earthquakes, the highest being 4.8 up in Fox Creek, Alberta, which pose a real threat to public safety because nothing has been built to withstand that level of man-made seismic activity.
Now, the heroine in your book is Jessica Ernst. Do you want to just give us a little introduction? Who is she?
Well, she's a remarkable woman and very different kind of character when you think about the enormous controversies that have been associated with fracking. So she's different in the sense that she's part of the industry. I mean, for more than 25 years, she worked for some of the country's largest oil and gas companies, including Encana, Murphy Oil, Chevron, the Great Canadian Oil Sands Company. So she brings to the story the perspective of somebody that knows the industry intimately, who thought it was actually being fairly regulated, and that if something went wrong, it would be addressed in due time. And she discovered that none of that was true. The other interesting thing about Jessica Ernst is that she's incredibly stubborn, obstinate, and incredibly determined. And she's now been in a lawsuit with the government of Alberta, Encana, and the energy regulator for 10 years. And what makes this, again, unique is that in most of these cases, people get tired, they get worn out, they get burned out, and they settle. And when they settle, any record of contamination is taken off the public record. You know, the companies will give you a check, you sign a confidentiality agreement, and then it all goes away. And regulators love this because then there's really no record of groundwater contamination or any problem. And why Jessica's case is so important and why I think industry and government are so concerned about it is, one, she's got the evidence, and two, she will not settle out of court. She wants it all on the public record.
So what brought her to the breaking point of saying, I'm going to have to sue the government and the company that I had worked for, Encana?
Well, what happened briefly was during an incredible fracking boom in central Alberta in the Horseshoe Canyon, Encana fracked a number of shallow coal bed methane wells. And one of those wells, it fracked directly into fresh water and affected a number of aquifers around the community of Rosebud. And when this was brought to Jessica's attention and when she started to investigate it and ask questions, you know, she ran into a brick wall with the regulator. Alberta Environment then conducted a really bogus investigation. I mean, to this day, Alberta Environment does not have a protocol for investigating methane contamination of groundwater related to oil and gas activities, which is astounding when you think that nearly 500,000 wells have been drilled in Alberta. And when she realized that the regulators weren't going to do the right thing, and when she realized that Encana was just ignoring it, she said, okay, I really have no choice here. I'm going to have to sue. And she did so reluctantly. I mean, nobody really wants to do this kind of thing. But she said, well, you know, groundwater is a public resource. And once it's contaminated, it travels. And you just can't walk away from that kind of abuse of a public resource. So she's been in the courts now for 10 years. Her case is going, actually, to the Supreme Court in January and February of this year in Canada, which is, again, a remarkable achievement.
You mentioned coal bed methane, and I've heard that in Australia and even in the UK, but I don't really understand. Are there two different kinds of fracking?
Well, no, fracking comes in all kinds of different ways. I mean, you can use gases to frack and crack rocks, such as nitrogen, and that's commonly used to crack open coal seams. You can use water, you can use petroleum distillate, gasoline, diesel fuel. You can use all kinds of different chemicals, and then you can also, and quite often you use a lot of sand or proppants to keep these cracks open so that the gas or oil can move from the fractured rock formation. The fracking of coal seams has got a fairly long history and a very problematic and controversial one. So they started fracking coal seam in the San Juan Basin in Colorado back in the 1980s. They did the same in Alabama, in Wyoming, and everywhere they did, they ran into problems. Coal is much more shallow than most oil and gas formations. It's also one of the world's most highly fractured rocks. And cracking it even more ultimately is just going to release a lot of that methane that's trapped in the coal. And I was just in Wyoming last week, where I met dozens and dozens of ranchers who lost their water as a result of the fracking of shallow coal seams in that state.
So, speaking of history, one incredible story in your book concerns using nuclear weapons for fracking. Did that really happen?
It did. I mean, the history of fracking is almost like something that Monty Python might have written about, but it's all about the escalation of brute force. You know, in the 1950s, they were fracking largely with diesel fuel, napalm, water, and river sand. And it was Halliburton and Schlumberger that pioneered that sort of fracking. And they were often very shallow fracks, and they were vertical in the wellbore. There was no horizontal fracking at that time. And then in the 1960s, scientists sort of thought, well, this is very labor-intensive, all of this vertical fracking. Maybe there's a shortcut. Maybe we could just set off a bomb in some of these very tight oil and gas deposits that are not economic to drill at the moment and see what happens. So they did. So Project Gas Buggy in Colorado took a nuclear bomb, and they blew it up underground, about 3,000, 4,000 meters underground, only to discover that there really is no market for radioactive gas. So the Russians did the same thing and also found that there is no market for radioactive oil or gas.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest journalist and author Andrew Nikiforuk. We're talking about his new book on fracking, Slick Water. What was the Alberta's government's response to complaints that fracking had ruined aquifers and people's drinking water? Did they come out to protect the public?
No, they didn't. What they did, number one, was they said, this is unfortunate, we'll look into it. But then their investigations were completely fraudulent, as I documented in the book. And then they said, well, it's all natural and it was always that way. There's always methane in groundwater. We shouldn't be too concerned about it. When in fact, when Jessica Ernst was presented with that story, she said, that's bullshit. And so she hired a hydrologist to actually go back and do a forensic look at groundwater around her community. And so she looked at, I think, at the record of 2,500 different water wells. And she found that only about four or five actually had any record. And when your water well is drilled and brought on, it is almost always tested for gas. And the public record will say gas present, yes or no. There was less than half a dozen wells in her area where there was gas present. And other scientists had said, too, the interesting thing about the coal basin that Encana and other companies fracked into later was that it was a very tight coal, and that, the methane really clung to the coal seams. And it took a lot of experimental fracking to get it to migrate to the surface. And again, people did not have problems with methane coming into their water wells until this massive experiment had taken place by fracking the coal.
Another problem I didn't fully understand until I read your book is the noise pollution from fracking operations. What happened to Jessica Ernst's peaceful homestead near Rosebud, Alberta?
Well, there are lots of different noise sources, but the one that has really driven a lot of rural people crazy are the compressors. So these coal formations are underpressurized, and once you frack them and the gas is released, you need to draw that gas up, and that's what the compressor stations do. They kind of act like these very noisy vacuum cleaners on the landscape. And the noise got so terrible for Jessica Ernst, and these compressor stations were nearly a mile away, that she could not sleep at night. There have been cases in Wyoming where residents have been driven crazy by the noise, and they've actually gone out and, with a 30-30 put holes in them, and have then, of course, been arrested by the state police. But what happens when this kind of oil and gas activity comes into a community, it basically industrializes the community. You get noise from heavy traffic because so many trucks are needed to surface these low-producing wells. You get noise from the compressors. You'll get noise from the actual fracking activity and drilling activity. And the whole quality of life of a rural place dramatically changes. Urban people would never tolerate the scale of industrialization that comes with fracking.
Right, and people went there to be peaceful in the first place. How does your story tie into terrorism? The police show up, and not just any police, on Jessica's doorstep. What happened there?
Well, it's, again, an interesting story. I mean, when Jessica went public with what happened to her water, the regulator responded by branding her a security threat and a criminal threat to the organization. And, I mean, this was a fraudulent claim. And they did so so that they wouldn't have to talk to her, and hoping that they would terrify her and shut her up for good. And they really didn't understand Jessica Ernst. And they later admitted, 6 months after they had banished all communication with her, that, look, Jessica, you never were a threat to us. We know you are not dangerous, but you publicly humiliated us by pointing out how negligent we were, and that's why we banished you. And so a couple of years after they did this, the RCMP came to her door as well. In fact, just a week after she was on national television in Canada, and it was members of the anti-terrorist squad. And so when they came up to Jess's place, she grabbed her camera and started taking photographs of them to have a record of it. She also fortunately had some neighbors at her house at the time, so she had witnesses. And the police were quite startled, and they had arrived unannounced, of course, and said, look, you can't take pictures of us. We're plainclothes policemen. And Jessica invited them to sit outside on her porch in metal chairs, and it was about minus 15 degrees outside at the time. And then they proceeded to interview her. And what they really wanted to know was what she found was to be absolutely appalling. They wanted to know the names and the phone numbers and addresses of all the ranchers and farmers that had called her for help over the years on issues related to fracking. And there were hundreds of them. And she said, no way, you're not getting any of that information. And why are you here? And why are you trying to harass me? Are you trying to silence me? And in the end, the policemen, who were very polite, also were very sheepish. And they apologized three or four times. And whoever sent them there, whether it was in Canada or the government, I don't know. But it was an example of how the state can terrify ordinary people when they are merely doing the right thing and trying to hold the state and their government accountable for the greater good.
Now look, with this lawsuit against Encana and the government, is Jessica Ernst in it for the money, and how does she pay for what must be big legal bills?
Well, she's not in it for the money, but in order to get the attention of the government in Canada and the regulator, you have to pick a big figure for a lawsuit. So she has sued all of them for negligence and breaking the law, as well as violating her constitutional rights for $33 million. And that sounds like a big sum, but in Canada, no lawsuit ever settles for that amount of money. And she's not in it for the money. To her, the big issue is to put this abuse of groundwater and rural people and all on the public record. And that's simply her goal. And at this point in time, she has spent $350,000 of her own money on this case. In the last year, I think ordinary citizens across Canada and the United States have contributed somewhere between $20,000 and $30,000 to her case. And 15% of the proceeds of Slick Water will go to support her legal challenge here.
So your book seems to make the case that winning a final judgment isn't really the biggest goal. I mean, what are the reverberations around the world of Jessica Ernst standing up for this?
Well, they are many. The first is that she has the scientific evidence that demonstrates that everything industry has said about fracking is false, that fracking does contaminate groundwater, that fracking does release gases that travel into other well bores and other formations and into other pathways that comes to the surface. And she's proven as well that one of the really big issues with fracking is that it rattles the existing oil and gas plumbing on the landscape and aggravates the existing problems with leaking gases. And so she's got all of the goods there, and she's got a really, really tight case, where she's caught a company fracking directly into groundwater and where she's caught a government that did not uphold the law and enforce the law. So if she is successful in the end, and if all of this is proven beyond any doubt in a court of law, then it could change the way fracking is regulated in Canada. Her case has already changed the attitudes of thousands of citizens about fracking. So in Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, I mean, Jessica Ernst is hailed as a folk hero, and her case is hailed as an example of how no one can properly regulate this highly dysfunctional and uncontrollable technology.
You know, I have to admit, I came away from reading your book with a slight feeling of hopelessness. Yes, we have brave individuals, we have citizen groups toiling for truth, but what a great machine of corruption and protection for pollution, you know, coming from the very institutions that are supposed to be protecting the public, so they say. In your heart of hearts, Andrew, do you think fracking in the tar sands will go on until the land, water, and climate are ruined? Or is there some hope that we could turn this around and make it sane?
Well, I don't think we can really make this technology sane. It is brute force technology. And there is a form of fracking taking place in the tar sands, and it's called the steam injection. And there are just as many problems with that as there are with fluid injection in oil and gas and coal deposits. But I always think about St. Augustine, who said that hope had two very brilliant daughters, and one was anger at the way things are, and the other was courage, the courage to change the things that must be changed. And Jessica Ernst is one of those sisters. And whether she actually finds justice at the end of the day in her case, and I actually believe she will, but it will take a long time and will take enormous amount of energy and emotion to get there, that her case is really going to make a difference.
All right. So, Andrew, you have a long history of books and articles that matter. What are you working on next?
Well, at the moment, I'm just working on how LNG and fracking in British Columbia poses risks and challenges to this good province.
Ah, yes, the LNG story. That's worth a book or three. Okay, so from Calgary, Alberta, we've been talking with Andrew Nikiforuk, a writer and author on environmental rights and wrongs, living in the Dragon's Den. Find out more at andrewnikiforuk.com. His last name is spelled Nikiforuk. And you can look for Andrew's new book, Slick Water, Fracking and One Insider's Stand Against the World's Most Powerful Industry. Thank you for your work all these years, Andrew.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. As always, you can download or forward these interviews as separate MP3 files using links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. I'll also load you up with links to follow on each story. I've had an ongoing discussion about solutions with Albert Bates. Regular listeners heard his talk and interviews at the recent Permaculture Convergence in London. Here's an excerpt from another talk I had with Albert, where I ask him about the mystery of our longing for news of the collapse and the real meaning of a permanent culture. Albert, maybe you can help me with a problem. If I do a Radio EcoShock show covering how bad things are, we get twice the downloads of a program with positive solutions like permaculture. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that people feel they sense the shadows that their future throws, which is a phrase that Ivan Illich coined. And I think it's appropriate because the future does look a bit dark and people are worried. People are sensing that there's something out there. They can't quite put words to it entirely. It's kind of an inchoate fear. It's just kind of lurking at the edges of their subconscious. And so they respond when you say something that's like, okay, this is the dire future. This is what's going to happen. And then this is going to happen. And then this could even happen. And oh my gosh, this could happen. Well, people sort of in a very deep level resonate with that. And that's why the downloads immediately pick up. They want to know. People want to know. And the sad thing is we can't really say with any certainty the more independent variables you have, the less you can say about the effect of any one of them. And so right now we're in this large, complex quantum entanglement of different vectors of finance and climate and the politics of the world and the peak everything. All of these lines that are coming across each other, as was predicted by the Club of Rome back in the 1970s, it's all coming to play right now. And so there's so little that anybody can predict that any prediction at all is grasped upon.
I think people have a hard time grasping what permaculture is, and you teach this subject in workshops around the world. So what the heck is permaculture?
That one's easy. You know, it was started by a couple of university folk back in Australia in the early or mid-1970s. Bill Mollison was teaching ecology in Tasmania, and his graduate student was David Holmgren. And David Holmgren brought him an idea for a thesis, and Bill sort of refined and honed it and got David working in the right direction. And what they were working on was the idea that agriculture as we know it, it has become very synthetic. It's become very dependent on fossil fuels and on different kinds of inputs that actually make it very vulnerable and brittle. We're reducing the number of crops to a very small number, the number of genotypes to even smaller. And so we tend to put ourselves in a situation where we're asking for trouble. And David looked more at the broad diversity of available crops and energy products and different kinds of things and said, you know, we could do this in a much more resilient, regenerative way. And they came to call that, the two of them, permaculture in the sense of permanent agriculture. But after a short amount of publishing on the subject, they came to realize it's not just agriculture. It's not just food. It's actually permanent culture. It's everything we do, the houses, the built environment in lots of ways, the infrastructure, the roads, the cities, the methods of transportation. All of these things actually can be done in a much more resilient, regenerative way, and it's a design process. And that's really the revelation, is that it is something that we are capable of designing better if we actually undertake to learn a design methodology. So permaculture is teaching a design methodology for what I would call a cultivated ecology. We want to follow nature. We want to do things the way that nature wants to go already. Nature is a magnificent healer. It's something with a billion-year store of knowledge. And so what we really want to do is just fall into step with nature and just tweak it to meet our needs a little bit here and there, go along with what its major programs are, but then get a little bit off for ourselves so we can have food and housing and so forth. That's permaculture.
Well, lately I'm hearing of permaculture economics, and probably permaculture psychology is next. Can the definition of permaculture grow so large that its core gets lost?
I don't think so. I think that actually permaculture economics is already here, and permaculture psychology as well. It's what we call social permaculture, and it's looking at relationships, how we form a glue that holds our community together, how we transform conflict into something that's more productive, how we can live together at peace and harmony and watch our children grow healthy and so forth. All of that's social permaculture. And I think that any design that doesn't account for the human factor, for the psychology of humans and their hurts and their needs and so forth, is actually a deficiency of the design. So you need to have that component of the social element, and permaculture is coming to that.
At the Convergence, Rosemary Morrow brought up the challenge that billions of humans now live in cities, not eco-villages or even agricultural areas. Can permaculture still work with that situation?
Well, I personally find that my largest challenge if ever I'm asked to do design work in an urban context. I'm not a city person. I have lived in cities. I went to school in New York City, and I've lived in a number of other cities, but I'm really a country boy. I am happiest when I'm out in the middle of nowhere. So for me, to venture into the city is always a bit of a challenge. And then to actually design a more resilient landscape that's in touch with nature, that's following the ways of nature within the urban canyons, I find it very difficult. But nonetheless, some of the principles, in fact, all of the principles, do apply. And if you can apply them there, you can have a much better life. And so we can capture rainwater. We can capture sunlight. We can grow things in cities. We can provide our own food. We can provide many of our needs. And certainly the social environment is very rich. The cultural environment of cities is very rich. I would part company with those who say that the ecological footprint of a city per resident is smaller than the ecological footprint of someone living in a rural area. I just don't buy that. I've seen the math, I've seen the analysis, and I understand where they're coming from. But I have to say, it doesn't quite work like that, because cities draw from the periphery to a great extent. There's a food shed that feeds the city. There is a watershed that feeds the city. There are all these different things that have to come together for a city to function, and most of those are neglected externalities in the economics that tells you that cities somehow have a small footprint. They don't. They have an enormous footprint. Can we support cities? Well, if you go back 10,000 years to after the last ice age when we didn't have much in the way of cities, and then gradually cities began to arise, particularly on trade routes, you know, along the Silk Road and so forth, you began to see Minoan cities and Greek cities and Egyptian cities and so forth. You began to concentrate wealth. You began to draw wealth, which is to say aggregates of natural resources, from the periphery to the center in these cities, and it allowed for very productive relationships. You can have worker classes of people, craftspeople, who could begin to learn how to do things to a very high degree of skill. All of those were wonderful innovations, and they created the civilization that we know. But on the other hand, they were a break with the natural order of things. In our DNA, we are essentially critters that grew in tribes of 10, 12, 20 people at the most, and wandering bands, and living in sync with the natural seasons and so forth. And so when we broke and created a city culture, we made a major shift, and that has to be taken into account. And a lot of what we get in terms of social malaise and crime and disagreements amongst people living as close neighbors comes from the fact that we are running contrary to our own DNA programming. And so we have to actually allow for that in any design. In designing the built environment, you have to design privacy gradients. You have to design solar streets and wilderness alleys, places where you can have fingers into the forest, where you can actually touch nature, where you can feel the soil, where your children can actually run wild a little bit. All of those are parts of our nature that we need to account for, and cities have to accommodate that in the design of them in the future.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Stay tuned in the coming weeks for more of my discussion with Albert Bates, former environmental lawyer turned permaculture teacher at the intentional community The Farm in Tennessee. Find links to Albert in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Next week, I'm scheming to bring you a devastating report on the lies we tell ourselves about climate change, and that's just as world leaders prepare for the Paris climate talks. It's harsh news that needs to be told. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for being brave enough to listen and for caring about our world.
Hello, skeptics, not our friends. We've come to share with you again data proving that the Earth's warming is a phenomenon. Because the carbon that we burn with such little care has warmed the air. Among the sound of skeptics, it's not as if this is unknown. The truth's consistently shown that global sea levels are rising, but governments are left compromising, and the public misinformed by your false logic and cherry picks still hear the sound of skeptics. And in the AR-5 we saw projections that left us in awe. Droughts and floods without warning. Less and less Arctic ice forming. And the cure, we have to cut our emissions bare. But still you dare create the sound of skeptics. What else will we need to show before we agree it's time we go? Build infrastructure that's sustainable, an RCP that is attainable, but propaganda you spread for the average Joe just steals the show and promotes the sound of skeptics.
I think we're joined now by Thomas Mountain. Are you there, Mr. Mountain? The man from the mountain.
Good to be back in Guantanamo. Toronto.
You are in a – we just talked to a man who tried to deliver medical supplies to Yemen, and the Saudis bombed him. I bet you weren't surprised at that kind of behavior.
Well, it's not only the Saudis. The American Navy blocked the Iranian supply ship and forced it to detour to Djibouti.
Indeed.
They prevented the Iranians from landing the supply ship.
We heard talk that something might be developing there in a way of negotiations or whatnot. Your latest article, America's Failed States Policy. What's going on there in Yemen? A destroying of the system, per se?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's reports now that the Americans have bypassed the Saudis and are negotiating with the Houthi rebels in Yemen, in Oman. Mm-hmm. So, in the case of Yemen, the United States, of course, is like Somalia. If they can't control the government there, the last thing they want is an independent, nationalist, potentially Islamic government in a power at the very mouth of the Bab al-Mandeb, the gateway between the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean, because all the trade between Asia and Europe, which is the biggest trading partners in the world and some one-third of all the world's oil, passes through there every day. So who controls the Bab al-Mandeb controls the two biggest economies in the world, Asia and Europe. Mm-hmm. So the last thing the United States wants is either in Somalia or in Yemen to have a strong, independent, nationalist, potentially Islamic government there. Mm-hmm. So if they can't control it, yes, they prefer a failed state. And, in 2006, the Union of Islamic Courts brought peace to Mogadishu for the first time in 15 years and established a government in Mogadishu. And what did the Americans do? Because they were independent, nationalist, and Islamic, they sent the Ethiopian army in to destroy that and basically launched what became Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab used to be a part of the youth wing of the Union of Islamic Courts, and it was the Ethiopian invasion which drove out the older, more conservative nationalist elements and left the young Al-Shabaab, which in Arabic means the youth, there to fight the Ethiopian occupation. And what became of that was today the group in Somalia that's causing all this trouble called Al-Shabaab. Well, in Yemen, there was peace in Yemen, and there'd been a deal worked out way back in 1990 under the mediation of what was then the rebel Eritrean People's Liberation Front, which brought both North and South Yemen together and negotiated a peace and a unity government in Yemen. And then that kind of lasted for a long time, and then the Americans stepped in and took over and got the former president, Saleh, to allow the Americans to come in and start drones and assassination and this massive campaign of murdering people in the name of fighting al-Qaeda. And, it led to this situation where eventually the conditions in Yemen got so bad that the Yemen people just couldn't take it anymore, and there was this uprising and the alliance between the Yemen army, which is headed by the son of the former President Saleh, and the Houthi militias, who have been fighting the Saleh-led government for many years. Mm-hmm. And, they made a move to take over the government, and stabilize the place. Well, America can't have that. But the interesting thing is the U.S. military was firmly against the Saudis going into Yemen. This, the United States military, they actually had some of their spokesmen, unofficial spokespersons, come out and criticize what the Saudis are doing. Because the military were at least aware of the fact that the potential dangers of having a war against the Yemeni people, where this could lead, because the Bab al-Mandeb at its narrowest is only about 12 miles across, which puts it in range, meaning all the ships passing through within range of even light artillery. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the potential for having several thousand artillery pieces stationed along the Yemeni coast, shelling ships going through there, is a nightmare of the U.S. military. So, you know, they're against it. And
but theirs is not the reason why theirs is, but to do in whatever.
Well, the cowards in the U.S. Central Command, the military leadership, the generals are politicians, and they're really cowards. I mean, they wouldn't come out and say this is a disaster publicly. And
well, the headquarters is in Florida, you remember. Florida. That's how close they are to this.
Yeah, well, you know, they've come out now, and apparently the Americans and the Houthi militias are negotiating, because Americans realize if this keeps going on, this is going to turn into a major disaster. But wouldn't that be a disaster?
I mean, Saudi Arabia, you point out, this. You had an earlier article using and bringing in the haunted name Vietnam for Saudi Arabia. Unless they really prevail, the ball could roll back toward them, couldn't it?
Oh, there's already blowback. But see, the situation in Saudi is that they have a new king, and the king put his favorite son, who's only 29 years old and with no military background, he put him in as the Minister of Defense. This guy's got no background, and he decides that what Saudi needs to do is to start showing their military strength. And so they're going to go out and they're going to, you know, go and attack Yemen and sort the matter out, make an example to Iran that they, you know, the Saudis are strong. Well, that's all backfiring on the Saudis.
I mean, they were good at beating up on Bahrain, but these are real fighters.
Yeah, the Houthis are real fighters. The last time the Saudis fought with the Houthis in 2009, they got their behinds kicked, and the Houthis ended up capturing a sizable chunk of Saudi territory. And Saudis had to apparently pay them many millions of dollars to pull back. Mm. So, you know, the Saudis they know better than to go in on the ground against the Houthis.
Well,
they
must have their fingers crossed with these talks. Let me ask you a question. I never understood, nobody's explained, why is Oman so quiet about this? Because the other Gulf states all said, oh, yeah, we're with you, but not Oman.
Well, Oman's actually pretty close to Iran. And Oman, the government there is much more moderate. They're not this Wahhabi sect that the British installed in the Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and in Kuwait and Bahrain. The Omanis are more of a moderate Sunni sect, and they're not nearly as fanatic, and they're much more tolerant. They've got historical ties with Iran and with Yemen.
And then they share a choke point too on the other side of the peninsula.
Yeah. That's right. So Oman is they didn't join in this, and they've always been more of a, you know, in between, because they're actually quite close economically to Iran. Hmm. But see, this failed state policy is not always a deliberate. I mean, the American government can do such idiotic things that it's not always, you know, a deliberate. I mean, it's not like, let's go make a failed state here. What happens is, just to their own blundering, to their own incompetency, the policy becomes failed state, that they do stupid things that create a failed state. I mean, you know, they didn't think when they went into Iraq that they were going to have a failed state, but that's what they ended up with, because they're so stupid. I mean, George Bush didn't even know there was such a thing as Shia and Sunni. Hmm. So, you know, that was surprised him when he found that out after the fact. I mean, so, you know, there's times when it's conscious that, like in the case of Somalia, they would rather have a failed state than a strong, united, nationalist, potentially Islamic government there. In the case of Libya, you know, it's clear they destroyed it, and it was clear that they wanted to destroy the Gaddafi government. And I don't think even they realized that they were going to end up with that badly a failed state situation in Libya. But, you know, they would still, rather than to have the potential threat of Gaddafi funding a rival to the International Monetary Fund with a $40 billion investment fund, that Africa could break the shackles of neocolonialism and the financial control of the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, with the new African Investment Bank that Gaddafi was going to fund. Yes. You know, it's going to break the Africa out of the control of the dominant financial terrorists that have dominated Africa now since so-called independence, which I prefer to call neocolonialism. Yes. So, you know, they would rather see Gaddafi in Libya, a failed state, than that happen. So,
yes.
You know, there's a lot of times when it's deliberate that the policy has come in and see a failed state if they can't control the situation.
It's the preferable solution.
Yeah, they prefer that.
And last minute here, Thomas, I want to ask you, you raised the point that a lot of this policy is based on crowding China out, and you point out in South Sudan that the U.S. feels they've succeeded because the Chinese are prevented from continuing the oil business. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, well, you know, the only party to benefit from the civil war in South Sudan is the United States. Because the only Chinese-controlled oil field in Africa is in South Sudan. So it's in the United States' national interest to deprive China of access to the African energy market, which is one of the potentially biggest in the world, and undeveloped energy markets. So the Chinese had the oil fields in South Sudan. The Americans, the ones that wanted to get them out. The Americans actually instigated a war, a fight between South Sudan and Sudan, over allegedly over the price of the oil being transported to the oil pipelines, and got the Chinese kicked out. They actually shut the fields down by promising the South Sudanese government that they would fund them something like the tune of $200 million a month. Well, then the Americans reneged on that, and so the Salva Kiir government of South Sudan went back to the Chinese, got an $8 billion emergency loan, and reopened those oil fields, which pissed the Americans off. So what the Americans' response? They got the Ethiopians to come in and fund the so-called rebel army of Riek Machar, the supposedly vice president of South Sudan. Now, it's been a year and a half since the war has broken out in South Sudan, and there's still some oil is flowing. I mean, the Chinese have put 500 peacekeepers in around the oil field, and they've got the oil flowing again now, some of it. So there's been attacks on those oil fields, but the Chinese, nobody's talking about the Chinese peacekeepers there. But Riek Machar can't explain where he's getting any of his money, the so-called rebels. The South Sudanese government headed by Salva Kiir can explain. They've got some money coming in. But for a year and a half, Riek Machar has got, 15, 20,000 soldiers under his command. He's got to pay their salaries. He's got to feed them. He's got to provide fuel for their transport. He's got to provide ammunition. Where's he getting all that money from?
Yeah.
No one's talking about that.
Who's
funding this guerrilla war?
Exactly.
And the fact is, it's Ethiopia and acting as a proxy for the United States. And it doesn't take a whole lot of intelligence to figure out that the United States is the only beneficiary of this war, and who's the mysterious funder of Riek Machar? And what's Riek Machar's role? To get to shut down the Chinese oil fields in South Sudan. Now, everybody's making it seem like this is tribal violence and black-on-black violence in Africa, and Africans are animals, and all they can do is kill each other, and it's just a really sickening situation, and you know, Africans really don't deserve independence, and they can't even govern their own country. And again, when you really dig down a little bit, you find out that it's outside sources, in this case the United States, that's behind all this violence in South Sudan, all these hundreds of thousands of people starving. It's all, who's paying for it?
Yep.
And that's a question nobody in the Western media is asking, and it's so obvious.
Well,
how can Riek Machar fight a war?
That's why we turn to Thomas Mountain. Thomas, it's great talking to you, and you're a great source. Failed states policy and all your writings. Thanks very much.
Okay, Phil. Thanks for having me.
Look forward to seeing you. Bye-bye. That's Thomas Mountain. And writing from Eritrea, and he's absolutely right, of course. Most of these things you really actually will not find out from the BBC or the New York Times. You have to go to Thomas Mountain if you want to know. That's why we called him up.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jessa Bonner of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who assesses the full text of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, revealing a free trade agreement that advances corporate rights. Climate activist Tim DeChristopher, who talks about the danger of false optimism in the difficult struggle ahead combating climate change. And Kaylin Jordan, co-founder of UncokeMyCampus.org, who discusses her group's work to expose and challenge the Koch brothers' funding of hundreds of colleges and universities across the U.S. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a blow against the war on drugs, Mexico's Supreme Court ruled it is legal for individuals to grow or consume marijuana for personal use. While the case did not overturn Mexico's harsh drug laws, the ruling opened a path to eventual legalization of pot in the nation which is the main exporter of marijuana to the U.S. Several Latin American nations in recent years have moved to decriminalize various classes of drugs. 2 years ago, Uruguay moved to legalize marijuana, Chile has recently harvested its first crop of medical marijuana, and Colombia's President Juan Manuel Santos has halted the aerial spraying of illegal coca fields. In 2009, Mexico decriminalized possession of small amounts of marijuana, cocaine, and heroin. But many Mexicans, including the nation's president, Eugene Peña Nieto, continue to oppose the legalization of cannabis, fearing that it would open the door to increased drug use. Drug reform advocates insist legalization will undermine the power of the drug cartels and reduce the levels of violence associated with the war on drugs, which has caused the deaths of 100,000 Mexicans over the last decade. Voters in Maine reaffirmed their support for public financing of state elections, overcoming the opposition of Tea Party Governor Paul LePage and the Maine Chamber of Commerce. The Maine Clean Elections Initiative will boost the amount of taxpayer funds given to qualified candidates in state elections and boost transparency of campaign spending. Maine's clean election system was first approved by voters in 1996 and proved popular with many candidates. Yet the U.S. Supreme Court's Citizens United decision and another in an Arizona case left Clean Election Act candidates vulnerable to big spending by privately funded opponents. In 2014, independent groups spent $14 million to influence Maine elections, an amount greater than that spent by the candidates themselves. Under a new formula approved by 55% of Maine voters, candidates for governor will be eligible for $3.2 million in public financing, candidates for state senate can receive $65,000, and those in state house races, $16,500. Nationally, campaign reform advocates praised recent ballot initiative victories in Maine and in cities including Seattle and San Francisco as opening a new chapter on limiting the power of money in politics. Josh Silver of the group Represent U.S. asserted, "Local grassroots victories are how we fix our corrupt political system. We are fighting for a future where political outcomes are decided by the best ideas, not by the biggest bank account." On the campaign trail, Hillary Clinton is promoting reform of gun laws as a core election issue for Democrats. This is in contrast to 2008, when Clinton was largely silent on the issue of gun violence. The former Secretary of State ramped up her rhetoric on the issue after the June massacre of 9 parishioners at an African-American church by a white separatist in Charleston, South Carolina. During a recent campaign event in Iowa, Clinton called out the National Rifle Association and pledged to make gun control a, quote, voting issue that motivates Democrats in the same way gun rights motivates Republicans to vote. By focusing on gun safety, Clinton has put progressive U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders on the defensive. Vermont has some of the weakest gun laws in the country, and during the 1990s, Sanders voted against the Brady Bill, which required mandatory background checks for gun buyers. The third Democrat in the race, former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, has pledged to issue 7 executive orders to reduce gun violence if elected next year. In recent months, Hillary Clinton has also proposed major criminal justice reforms, including her endorsement of the movement to ban the box, which would prohibit federal contractors from asking job applicants about their criminal records during initial screenings. Still, Clinton faced a vocal protest in Atlanta from Black Lives Matter activists who disrupted her speech at the historically black Clark Atlanta University. The moment was emblematic of how criminal justice reform has emerged as a pivotal issue in the 2016 presidential race. Clinton opponents Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley both contrasted their support for abolishing the death penalty with Clinton, who wants to retain the use of capital punishment in certain egregious cases. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
On November 5th, the Obama administration released the full text of the proposed 12-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. The controversial pact, which will cover trade rules integrating 40% of the world's economy, must now be voted on by the U.S. Congress. With the release of the full text of the agreement, Congress now has 90 days to review the TPP before President Obama can ask for an up or down vote under the terms of fast-track legislation approved in June. Opponents of the trade deal, including a broad coalition of labor, environmental, and consumer groups, assert that the actual elements of the agreement, now made public, are worse than originally feared. They cite an extension of intellectual property rights in the pact that will increase the cost and reduce access to critical life-saving drugs, the offshoring of thousands of U.S. manufacturing jobs to cheaper labor markets, and the flooding of the U.S. with unsafe and unlabeled imported food. Another divisive provision of the TPP, the Investor State Dispute Settlement, or ISDS, allows multinational corporations to challenge local, state, and federal public health, environmental, consumer, and labor laws, as well as court rulings, if a claim is made that they impinge on business profits. Your reporter spoke with Jessa Bonner, International Program Associate with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who summarizes the full text of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which she and other opponents believe advances corporate rights at the expense of citizens' rights.
The TPP is requiring new marketing exclusivities and patent term extensions, which is going to harm access to medicine. These new, what is known as marketing and data exclusivity rules, actually delay generic drug registration for a specific period of time. And so we see that these terms in the TPP are going to contribute to what could be preventable suffering and death. And also one of the most controversial parts of this is the issue of access to biologic medicines, which are medicines that are used by patients that are fighting cancer, among some other diseases. And so we saw that at the behest of big pharmaceutical companies in the U.S., that the U.S. was really pushing this really extreme agenda in terms of the monopoly patent terms for these biologic medicines. And though while the countries did not give in to what the U.S. was pushing, which was an automatic monopoly term that was longer than 5 years, actually up to 12 years at one point, USCR insisted on including some text that actually allows the U.S. government to pressure and pull countries towards a longer period. So it's kind of undefined between 5 and 8 years, but it goes beyond this five-year period. And another issue, an e-commerce chapter that actually undermines consumer privacy protections for sensitive personal, health, financial, and other data when it crosses borders by basically exposing these policies to challenges as a violation of TPP's limit on regulation and data flows. So this includes rules that could require countries to allow unregulated cross-border transfer of Internet users' data and prohibit governments from requiring companies to host data on local servers. So that's another major issue related to intellectual property in the TPP.
Jessa, I wanted to ask you about food safety and inspections and GMO crops, which all are dealt with in the TPP text that we now have. Can you tell us about that?
So one thing that we're seeing in the TPP is that it's going to require the U.S. to import seafood, meat, and poultry that doesn't necessarily comply with our safety standards. So basically that means that under the TPP, the U.S. would be required to allow food imports if the exporting country's safety regime is deemed as what's known as equivalent to our own, even if it's not the same or maybe it violates our food safety laws. There will be a big increase in imports, but not necessarily an increase of inspection at the border. So right now, in terms of some of the seafood that's coming into our country, the FDA is really only inspecting about 1% of it and finding issues in that 1%. This means there's going to be just a major increase. Another big concern, as you mentioned, is the issue of labeling of food, labeling things as GMO, free, et cetera. So under the TPP, these food labels could potentially be challenged as a trade barrier. And this is something that's happened in the past. We've seen this happen in other trade venues, such as a very popular provision, which is known of country of origin labeling, which basically requires for consumers to know what country their meat is coming from, which seems to make a lot of sense, especially if, you know, there's concerns there could potentially be temporary outbreak of some kind of disease, et cetera. You might want to know to make sure that, you know, for that time being, to not be choosing meat from that particular area. But that was actually upheld at the WTO as a trade violation. So there's a big concern about the implications of the safety of our food in the TPP.
What's the timeline for voting Congress on this free trade treaty? And maybe you could describe for us the coalition of groups that are working to defeat it when that vote actually comes up.
I mean, now that we've seen what's in the text, and we've known that there are a lot of really concerning things, but now that we can see, you know, that the things that were ultimately negotiated are worse than we could have expected, it's only going to kind of increase the amount of opposition to this deal. So Obama did actually last week give his notice of intent to sign to Congress. So that starts kind of a 90-day clock from when Congress could conceivably vote on the TPP. But we're still seeing a lot of opposition in Congress. Some of the biggest proponents of this agreement are saying they don't think there's going to be a vote in 2016. We have an election coming up. So it's really kind of unclear that this is going to be something that's going to be able to get through Congress anytime soon. I mean, there were many members of Congress that said they would support the TPP if, at a minimum, it included these past reforms that were made, as I mentioned, to intellectual property rules for access to medicine, as well as the environment. But what we've seen is that the TPP has actually been a rollback of these things. So that's going to cost some support of some members. And as you mentioned, there's an unprecedented number and wide array of organizations that are opposing any attempt to push the TPP through Congress. And this is really kind of a wider coalition than we've seen working on these kinds of deals before. We're talking about all major labor unions, environmental groups, faith groups, human rights groups, consumer groups, groups that are working on internet freedom, etc. So what's really important is that we need to just make sure, especially now that we have seen the text and we know exactly what's in it and that it's going to be very harmful, that we're calling up our members of Congress, writing to them, tweeting at them, et cetera, and asking them to oppose the TPP, because the TPP can't become a reality if it can't get through Congress.
That was Jessa Bonner, International Program Associate with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. For more news and commentary on the campaign to defeat the Trans-Pacific Free Trade Agreement in Congress, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Climate activist Tim DeChristopher gained notoriety across the country when he served almost 2 years in prison for a nonviolent act of civil disobedience in 2008 by making false bids for gas and oil development leases. After his release from a federal prison, he enrolled at Harvard Divinity School with the goal of becoming a Unitarian minister. He's now taken a year's leave of absence to co-found the Climate Disobedience Center, which aims to provide support to activists who risk serious consequences for engaging in direct action to combat the causes of climate change. DeChristopher was a keynote speaker at the third annual Climate Stewardship Summit, held November 5th in West Hartford, Connecticut, organized by the Interreligious Eco-Justice Network, the Connecticut affiliate of the faith-based national organization Interfaith Power and Light. DeChristopher began his talk by giving examples of both good and bad news in the previous week. He mentioned the Obama administration's denial of TransCanada's request to put their bid to build the Keystone XL pipeline on hold. Obama went on to reject the permit to build the pipeline the day after the conference concluded. He also cited a bill introduced by 7 members of Congress, including presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, to keep all fossil fuels under public lands and waters in the ground. The bad news, DeChristopher mentioned, included China's admission that it had underestimated its carbon emissions from coal-burning power plants by 17%, or 1 billion tons a year of additional CO2, the planet's most damaging greenhouse gas. A portion of his talk, excerpted here, focused on the difference between hope and optimism, especially the false optimism he says many environmental groups project out of fear that people can't handle the truth about the serious challenges we face on combating climate change.
So we're holding these two extremes, this extreme paradox here, between so much positive progress and so much new opportunities in the expansion of the possible, and so much bad news. It seems to be closing down so many possibilities of actually preventing a significant collapse of our civilization. And so I think it's worth asking, how do we deal with that paradox and this divergent dual reality that seems to be stretching us farther and farther every day that goes by, just in the last 24 hours. And I think a significant chunk of the climate movement is making their choice, which is to let go of one side of that dual reality, to let go of the bad news. And the answer that I often get from a lot of climate movement folks and even a lot of climate scientists is that people really can't handle the truth, that you'll scare people into paralysis, that you'll push people into despair, and they'll never get up again. It was probably best articulated to me by Sarah Van Gelder, who's the editor of Yes Magazine. I was spending some time with her in Oregon a couple years ago, and we were having this conversation, and she said, well, if we tell people that it's too late to stop climate change, then what's to prevent them from abandoning all their values and giving up on the struggle for justice and just living as hedonistically as possible with whatever time they have left? I didn't have a particularly good answer for her at the time. All I could say was that if we don't find an answer to that question, then we're going to become increasingly irrelevant as a movement. And so answering that question has been a big focus of my work over the past couple of years. And so I've started digging deeper and thinking more into this idea that people need a sense of optimism in order to keep struggling, or people need to think that things are going to turn out okay in order to keep doing this work, and in order to not slide into a completely paralyzing despair. And I realize that a lot of this comes down to our views of human nature. And there are certain assumptions that we are making about human nature when we say that people need these easy answers, people can't really handle this full truth, people can't handle that kind of paradox of a whole world that could be lost, of so much that is already being lost, and yet so much to still fight for. That's too complicated for folks. And so I thought about what it means to be pursuing this work with that kind of a view of human nature. But the question is whether what is manifesting in our current alienated and consumer-driven society is actually human nature, or whether it's something that has been imposed on our society by those who profit from an ignorant and apathetic citizenry. So if we actually hold the view that level of apathy and alienation and ignorance and seeking easy answers that we see in so much of our society, if we hold the view that that's human nature, that can't be changed, then that's deeply, deeply pessimistic for our future. That puts us on a really dark path. And that to me is actually the scariest thing to think about for our future. Because that means whatever hardships are now inevitable, people will turn to those easy answers. And that's when things get pretty scary. If we're optimistic because we think people can't handle the truth, that's just optimism as a veil for a deeper kind of hopelessness. And it's not genuine hope. That's optimism as a flimsy and fragile kind of hope. But real hope is always on the side of truth. If we are misguiding people away from the truth because we're afraid that they can't handle the truth, that is not genuinely hopeful. Genuine hope is always on the side of truth.
That was Tim DeChristopher speaking at this year's Climate Stewardship Summit in West Hartford, Connecticut. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. For more information on DeChristopher's Climate Disobedience Center and related issues, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. One of the most active family-owned corporations opposing action on climate change in the U.S. are Kansas billionaires Charles and David Koch, owners of Koch Industries. The Kochs have given tens of millions of dollars to political candidates and groups that deny climate science, undermine policy solutions to the problem, and attack subsidies for clean energy competition, while preserving billions of dollars in handouts to fossil fuel companies. The Koch brothers also generally promote a radical brand of free market capitalism that advocates large tax cuts for the wealthy while cutting social safety net programs for poor and working families. Largely below the radar, the Kochs in recent years have steadily increased their grants to colleges and universities across the U.S. According to a database compiled by Greenpeace, the Kochs have donated nearly $50 million to 254 universities nationwide since 2005. Those funds support conservative economic research that promote the Koch's libertarian economic philosophy and the hiring of like-minded professors. On November 5th, a group called OnKochMyCampus.org, dedicated to exposing and challenging Koch brothers' money on campus, organized a national day of action to stop the corporatization of education. The protest, involving dozens of campuses, focused on publicizing the Koch's influence in political agenda and higher education in advance of the 2016 election. Your reporter spoke with Kaylin Jordan, co-founder of OnKochMyCampus.org, who discusses her group's demand for transparency by college administrators on what donations their institutions are receiving from the Koch brothers and the political influence it buys.
From 2005 until 2013, there has been $68 million at over 300 campuses from the Charles Koch Foundation and other Koch foundations. And that funding has been different from campus to campus, but it has usually gone to economic departments, business departments. It's funded professorships. It's funded research think tanks. It's gone into the classroom. And what we've seen when we've been able to get information, which has been really difficult, we've seen that the influence has taken place in the classroom. The Koch Foundation said at Florida State University that they wanted final decision-making over the hiring of professors that it was funded. We're seeing a lot of influence on research coming out of Suffolk, coming out of Utah State University, that then gets funneled directly into the Koch Foundation's political network. So what we've seen is that this work on college campuses that they're doing is very methodical, and it is just the first step in the overall political machine that is what the Koch entity does.
So what is your organization asking of college administrators when you talk about Koch money that's coming into the campus or your suspicions that it is Koch money? From my understanding, you're trying to get some transparency into the process of the funding that the Koch brothers may provide, and also finding out about the strings attached and the quid pro quos that may not be so obvious to students and faculty.
Absolutely. Transparency is our number one goal. We're hoping to get transparency of any Koch donation to a university, but we're also hoping that we can help universities put in place policies that won't just apply to the Kochs. It will apply to any donor so that any student, any faculty member, any member of that university community can understand what money is coming into the university and what string is attached and what influence it's having on their campus.
So one thing that caught my eye was your National Day of Action last week on Thursday, November 5th, where dozens of college campuses participated to bring attention to the Koch brothers' money on campus. Tell us a little bit about what happened on November 5th when all these members of your organization across the country worked to bring attention to Koch brothers' money on college campuses.
It was a fantastic day. We saw a lot of unity in the student activists and faculty on college campuses. We had 50 schools participate, and the actions that they did varied from posting a picture on social media saying, I want to uncoke my campus, saying what you were concerned about on campus, to students doing banner drops and handing out flyers on campus, to campaigns kicking off their first uncoke chapter on that day. And at American University, they introduced a model policy to stop, you know, the undue influence that we've seen from the Koch brothers. So our campuses did a lot of different things, and they spoke really loudly, and we started to see people take notice, people engage in the campaign that haven't before. So it was a really, really gratifying day of action, and we had great support from Student Labor Action Project and Food and Water Watch, so other organizations that are active on campus also participated, and that unity was really felt.
Kaylin, as we conclude here, if one of our listeners wanted to find out if their college or university was receiving funding from the Koch brothers, how would they go about doing that research?
It's actually really simple. So you can just go to uncokemycampus.org, which is our website. You can go to the resources page, and on that page we have a link to our interactive database where you can find out if your university has been Koch funded. We would really encourage anyone, whether they're a student, a faculty member, a grandparent of a student, an alumni, just a concerned citizen, to look into this, look into the university that you went to, look into the university in your hometown, and just see if it's Koch funded. And if you want to get involved, regardless of if you're in school or out of school, I'd encourage you to reach out to us. We want to work with anybody to get transparency around this issue and get some answers.
That was Kaylin Jordan, co-founder of uncokemycampus.org. Learn more about the group's mission and related information on the Koch brothers by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
There's a trend that's been happening for a long, long time where comparably wealthy people chase around poor people and kick them out of their living spaces. We now use the term gentrification to describe this social and economic phenomenon. Back in the old days, before FDR had the sprawling U.S. highway system built on the cheap by desperate folks who lost their jobs in the Great Depression, people wanted to live close to their work. And since factories were built largely in major cities, or else major cities popped up around the factories, that's where the workers lived. People with money were drawn to the city centers, and the poor were left in shantytowns and hovels on the fringes of the urban metropolises. Metropolises. Metropoles. Metropoli? I don't know. But anyway, it sucked to be in the burbs. As a consequence, the property values were really low. So when the highways magically appeared and everybody hopped into cars, the comparably wealthy folks said, "Hey! Let's get away from the ugly city and buy up some of this cheap property away from the smog and exhaust." Since they had the means to commute to work, they thought it would be awesome to scarf up the living places of the desperately poor on the fringes. Developers come in, boom, the suburbs. Condominiums, strip malls, McDonald's, Starbucks. Life was grand for the comparably wealthy, but the desperate poor couldn't afford to rent that condo or to drink the latte, whatever, whatever, at Starbucks. So, being displaced, the poor migrated to the city spaces vacated by the upwardly and outwardly mobile. They took the hand-me-downs of the inner city. So what we essentially had was a city center that was a ghetto, plagued with poverty, unemployment, crime, drugs, and a variety of social ills, and the poor were essentially held there in a kind of prison formed by the ring of high property values that held them in. We fast forward to today, and we have the same processes at work, only in reverse. We're putting benevolent names on it, like urban renewal and reinvestment, but the process is still the same. The comparably wealthy see areas where property values are depressed, so they begin buying up, quote, islands, unquote, of renovation, islands that receive more protection by the police. These islands are off limits to the poor and largely black city populations, while attracting a migration of more wealthy whites. Again, just like previous historical instances of the poor being displaced, the influx of these suburbanites raises the property values and drives the poor from the area. Gentrification. So how do we effectively oppose it? My first reaction, in the simple answer, is that we have to refrain from participating in the gentrification process. But what does that mean? Does that mean we just don't move into the new area and pay high rent that others cannot afford? That might be like a mandatory minimum requirement, I guess. But it seems to me that to effectively oppose gentrification, we have to identify all the profiteers who are gaining from gentrification, from the landlords to the corporate coffee shops. Once we identify them, we have to develop strategies for sabotaging their profits. That's what it boils down to, right? Because gentrification is driven by profit margin. So, in developing an anti-gentrification strategy, we have to develop an anti-profit strategy. We have to ask ourselves, if I were a slumlord or Starbucks or McDonald's, what would be the events that would drive me out of this neighborhood? What would force me to abandon the profit plans? And then do that. Some forms of resistance might be extreme single events that really rock the gentrifiers, while other forms of resistance are longer term, sustained actions. For stuff like that, you'd almost have to mobilize and inspire the local populace to take up the cause for themselves. You'd almost have to be able to articulate a vision of how folks getting gentrified could and should resist, connecting the dots between the profiteers and the rising rent prices that drive them into the new round of migration. Then, perhaps, those long-term sustained rebellions will occur seemingly on their own. One interesting idea would be to locate where the gentrifiers themselves live and follow them to their neighborhoods and impact the property values where they live. It's just an idea. As I'd like to point out quite frequently, gasoline is cheap and matches are free. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain being silenced by the prison official somewhere in the Ohio prison torture complex. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new address by directing it to Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren, CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. president in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
Listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
We got your back! Come on up! We got your back! Come on up! We got your back! Come on!
Low-wage workers coast to coast walked off their jobs and rallied in hundreds of cities Tuesday, the largest Fight for 15 action to date. At a Madison, Wisconsin McDonald's, police and store security kept protesters away from the building. But a few workers walked out to strike anyway. Just before they came out, a Pizza Hut worker, introduced only as Kayla, shared her experience as a pregnant low-wage worker unable even to qualify for the Family Medical Leave Act.
It's just really sad and depressing for me because I live in a one-bedroom apartment and I can't afford to take care of my electric bills, my car payments, and also have a little one on the way, and we need 15 in a union. That's what we need, and that's what I'm here for, is to fight to make sure that we get 15 in a union.
Striker Ron Cosby was forced to come out of retirement to work at McDonald's.
Come out of retirement to help my family to make ends meet, because it's hard out here working jobs at minimum wage. If we had a higher wage, our family would be living more comfortable than we are living now if the pay was $15 an hour.
Minimum wage fast food workers got support from clergy as they struck and rallied in hundreds of U.S. cities Tuesday. Michael Schuler is a senior minister at the First Unitarian Society in Madison.
We are here today to say that this has to change, and we join our minds and our hearts and our hands as we raise our voices in the fight for 15. Thank you.
85 FedEx drivers in Gardena, California, carried out a one-day unfair labor practices strike as efforts to organize at FedEx accelerate. They were supported on the picket lines by 300 Teamsters from Joint Council 42. Council 42 Teamsters organizer Randy Corgan says the attempted union busting that sparked this strike is happening at other FedEx locations. Corgan says the Teamsters are in for the long haul in the FedEx organizing effort, and strikes like the one in Gardena will inspire other FedEx workers to join the union effort.
Just from this action, hundreds of employees from all over the country have reached out in various ways asking what can they do to join in, how can they support the efforts here, as well as them starting to engage in discussions that maybe they do something like this on a larger scale.
Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio, live nationwide weekdays noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
WIN is made possible in part through underwriting support from the United Steelworkers and from OPEIU.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org. Connecticut nursing home workers have won a $15 an hour minimum wage. Nursing home workers say the tentative agreement covers 2,600 workers at nursing homes owned by iCare and Genesis. Back in April, nursing home workers in Connecticut voted to strike for the $15 wage. Governor Malloy asked them to postpone the strike and keep talking at the bargaining table. So after months of negotiations, the workers won the $15 minimum wage. Pensions at nursing homes that didn't have them are also part of the tentative deal. Jennifer Schneider of SEIU 1199 says this victory demonstrates the power of worker solidarity and struggle.
You know, the old saying, right, that without struggle there can be no progress. So it was a struggle, and workers hung tough. They hung together, which was, I think, the most important part. They were really demanding that they were worth at least $15 an hour.
Schneider says having thousands of Fight for 15 workers and their supporters in the streets nationwide is forcing politicians to pay attention to this issue. And that, she says, could have a big impact in the 2016 elections.
Having workers and having, you know, thousands of people taking to the streets and making this issue known that this is something that people are going to be voting on when they head to the voting booth. I mean, you see Hillary Clinton tweeting about it. You see the Republican debate where minimum wage is a question that's being asked. So, you know, people are having to go on the record where they stand. And, you know, we're hoping that we can make a big difference to really start having not only this addressed as an issue, but we can start electing officials who stand for a $15 minimum wage.
Unions at General Electric, the United Electrical Workers, United Auto Workers, Machinists, Steel Workers, Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Teamsters, and the Federation of Professional and Technical Engineers are suing GE over medical and pensions cuts. The unions contend GE is violating contracts that provided retirees lifetime medical benefits and pensions. GE told retirees it was changing the plans last summer. The suit filed by the unions say that GE's cuts violate federal labor law and the Employer Retirement Income Security Act. This suit was filed in the U.S. District Court in the Northern District of Ohio. IUECWA President James Clark says GE is breaking its promises to retirees during the most vulnerable time of their lives after they worked for the company for decades.
Let's get America working. We must build, maintain, and repair our nation's crumbling infrastructure. Teamsters support a bipartisan approach to creating good jobs for American workers. Learn more at letsgetamericaworking.com. Teamsters strong, America stronger.
Workers Independent News is heard daily on The Rick Smith Show, live 3 to 6 p.m. coast to coast at therickSmithShow.com. The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org. United Steelworkers Vice President Tom Conway says the movement to change America's still dysfunctional health care system must keep organizing until a tipping point of change is reached. Speaking at a single-payer healthcare conference in Chicago, Conway said the Affordable Care Act is a big problem for the steelworkers, and it's a brutal place out there, he says, trying to bargain with employers on healthcare. He says health insurance for workers keeps getting more expensive while coverage narrows. He says doctors, workers, and single-payer universal healthcare activists are actively building a movement to change our dysfunctional healthcare system.
We'll just keep growing this and growing it until we hit the tipping point we need, but we can't give up. This is exactly the right way to do it. Put everybody in a room together. Give us all time to get comfortable with each other. Move off and just keep organizing and keep driving. And we're going to change the way this works. Because this country can't sustain this kind of a dysfunctional system.
National Nurses United RNs from Iowa and several nearby states will rally for Bernie Sanders in Des Moines Saturday prior to the Democratic presidential candidate's debate. The nurses from Iowa, Missouri, Minnesota, Illinois, and Kansas will also canvass for Sanders before the rally at Drake Park near the Drake University debate site. Labor organizer and author Jane McAlevey is urging labor to talk more to workers and to train thousands in how to fight back. It's an organizing versus mobilizing model. She's not anti-mobilizing. She just believes more effective organizing on the ground is essential. In an interview with Jacobin magazine, McAlevey says that one of the problems with labor movement strategy is that the movement stopped actually listening to workers, disregarding our intelligence. She says arrogant, highly educated leadership emerged around 1995 that believed they were smarter than workers. To rebuild a powerful movement, McAlevey says, we need to focus on people who are not yet with us, and we have to be clear on the differences between activists and organic leaders who have real influence on the ground among workers. She says we won't get there through social media or multi-million-dollar PR firm portraits that are being painted in the media. She says the Fight for 15 movement is using mobilizing, but doesn't have any real organized depth, in her opinion. She's calling for the labor movement to prioritize teaching, beefing up skills, and training tens of thousands of workers how to really fight day to day on the ground, not just show up for mobilizations.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor. Bank of Labor has provided trust and fiduciary services to labor organizations for nearly a century. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Does the replacement of the hawkish former Prime Minister Stephen Harper with the more progressive Justin Trudeau signal a fundamental shift toward a more peaceful Canadian foreign policy? In what ways is Canada profiting from war? Do the NDP or the Greens represent a principled alternative when it comes to the militarization of Canadian foreign policy? What role do military partnerships such as NATO play in pushing for a militarization of Canadian policy? What is behind the failure of the anti-war movement to address these issues? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we discuss these questions and Canada's involvement in the arms trade with a leading anti-war activist and researcher, Richard Saunders. On this week's program, Trudeau and the Canadian Military-Industrial Complex, a conversation with Richard Saunders. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 13th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The U.S. Navy's decision to fire off a thermonuclear missile, unarmed or not, into the western skies overlooking Los Angeles was sending a clear, indisputable message to the entire world. By making it such a public spectacle witnessed by hundreds of thousands in America's second largest metropolis, Washington's clear intention was launching another recklessly alarming shot across the bow aimed directly at warning Russia and China to, quote, back off or else, unquote. The range of the Trident II missiles launched is 4,000 nautical miles within full reach of Beijing. What is most evident is that the U.S. government is reacting to Russia and China's challenge to U.S. global dominance as the world's most powerful nation on Earth. The message is clear. Continue challenging America's previously uncontested belligerent rule over the planet, and the U.S. will instigate a global war. That comes from the article, The War Drums Are Beating. Two Trident missiles launched over Los Angeles, active provocation directed against Russia and China, by Joachim Hagopian, posted November 11th. What the Russians have provided is an absolutely vital and very daring last-minute temporary solution to a very dangerous situation about to get much worse. They did that knowing full well that they were at a huge political, geographic, and military disadvantage and that their move was extremely risky. I would not say that Putin is risk-averse, but he is certainly very cautious, and for him to have authorized such an operation must have been very difficult. My guess is that what made him decide in favor of this intervention is the correct belief that the Russian forces in Syria are not only fighting for Syria, but that they are first and foremost fighting for Russia. Every Wahhabi Takfiri organization on the planet has already declared a jihad against Russia, and Russia has been fighting these crazies ever since the USA and the Saudis literally federated them in Afghanistan, the brilliant plan of Brzezinski and later Reagan. That comes from the article, Russia's Intervention in Syria, a Reality-Based Evaluation by the Saker, posted November 11th. According to a report by Al Gamener, November 11th, 2015, Israel's Air Force was involved in bombing inside Syria, hitting targets close to Damascus Airport. This report begs the question as to the ultimate objective of Netanyahu's visit to Washington. The Israeli delegation to Washington was also integrated by military and intelligence officials who no doubt had meetings with their counterparts at the Pentagon and Langley, not to mention the U.S. Congress. A week prior to the Obama-Netanyahu summit, Netanyahu dispatched his defense chief, Moshe Bogi Ya'alon, to Washington, quote, to help smooth the way for his own visit, unquote. Was there an understanding that Israel would henceforth play a more active role in the war against Syria? In an earlier statement, Defense Secretary Ashton Carter intimated, quote, it is a reasonable expectation that the defense relationship with Israel will be one of stability and endurance, unquote, quoted by Defense One, November 3, 2015. Ya'alon was hosted in Washington by Defense Secretary Ashton Carter, who is credited for having stabilized the U.S.-Israel relationship. Were these talks between Carter and Ya'alon behind closed doors indicative of a shift in U.S.-Israel military relations, especially with regard to Syria? That's from the article, Has Israel's Air Force Joined Obama's Air Campaign Against Syria? Israeli Jets Strike Damascus Targets, by Professor Michelle Chalzadovsky, posted November 12th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Stephen Harper, arguably the most hawkish prime minister in Canadian history, has been replaced by a more progressive-sounding leader, the Liberal Justin Trudeau. He's promised to withdraw Canadian fighter jets from the war theater in ISIS-controlled parts of Syria. But is his military policy likely to be substantively different from that of his predecessor? How extensive is Canada's involvement with international military conflicts? To address these questions, we're joined right now with Richard Saunders. Richard Saunders is coordinator of the Coalition to Oppose the Arms Trade and editor of its magazine, Press for Conversion. He joins me from Ottawa. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, Richard Saunders.
Yeah, hi.
So the Liberals said they would withdraw their fighter jets from the war theater during the election campaign, though that hasn't really happened yet. Though they also said that they would support increased military training of fighters on the ground. But in your estimation, how extensive is Canada's role in this military offensive, ostensibly aimed at the Islamic State?
Well, first of all, you're right. They haven't withdrawn the CF-18 fighter bombers. In fact, the new Trudeau government, they have actually increased the number of airstrikes done by CF-18s. So that's quite interesting, that not only have they not withdrawn these CF-18s yet, they've actually increased the bombing raids by the CF-18s. So just yesterday there was another bombing raid, and Trudeau said that, in coming weeks, they would have an announcement about the withdrawal of CF-18s. Why can't they just withdraw them now? He said in his statement yesterday that they had to be concerned about, coordinating with their allies. That seems to be of more significance, coordination with their military allies in this war, than fulfilling their promises that they made during the campaign, election campaign, and actually just stopping the bombing raids. Mm. It's more important to just cooperate with the Americans, I guess.
Priorities, I guess.
Yeah. So I think what we're seeing is that the Liberals, as throughout Canadian history, really, the Liberals and Conservatives are not really that different. You can point to lots of examples of wars that took place, unjust wars that took place under the Liberals. The bombing campaign of the CF-18s in Iraq and Syria now is going to continue for at least the time being. There's nothing really that is stopping them from just saying, okay, as of today, we're not going to do any more bombing raids with our CF-18s. They could just stop it, but they're not.
Yeah. Policy that was embraced by the Conservatives was this huge sale, a $15 billion deal to sell armored vehicles to Saudi Arabia. I don't imagine you see that changing under Mr. Trudeau either.
No, he said quite clearly during the election campaign, as did the NDP as well, it was a similar, they had the same policy, that they would not cancel that deal with Saudi Arabia. It's apparently the largest export deal in Canadian history. I'm not sure if that's the largest military export deal or the largest deal of any kind. Probably, I guess, it's just the largest military export deal. Anyway, it's huge. To Saudi Arabia, a country, of course, where women are forced to wear coverings, which was a big issue for Harper. Interestingly enough, it's okay to sell billions of dollars worth of military equipment to Saudi Arabia, but a few women wearing these things in Canada is somehow a major problem that we have to deal with.
Saudi Arabia is also involved in a military campaign in Yemen, which is killing a lot of people.
Right, and they've used Canadian light armored vehicles, which are equipped with weapon systems as well. They've been used in neighboring wars in the past. Saudi Arabia sent them out to help their neighbors, their other monarchies that are in trouble over there. So it's really disgraceful, the whole military export deal that we're talking about here to Saudi Arabia. But the fact that the Liberals and the NDP did not say that they would. In fact, they said they would not cancel that deal. Another big military deal that both the NDP and the Conservatives said they would not cancel, the Liberals said they would cancel it, is the F-35, which is the Joint Strike Fighter. It's a most advanced warplane, bomber, fighter, jet that is now in existence or in production. But that, curiously enough, this which has gotten a lot of media attention over the years, this F-35 or JSF, that process was started in 1997 in Canada under a Liberal government. So the Liberals began to help produce and pay for and work towards the purchase of these F-35s back in 1997. And they were in power until 2006. And during that whole period of 9 years, they continued to support and promote and invest in the F-35 program. And then in 2010, the Conservatives, when they were in power, they announced their intention to buy the F-35s. So they sort of finalized the deal, but it had been started by the Liberals. And under the Liberals, the Industry Canada, D&D, and Public Works were deeply invested in this thing, and the Liberals spent $150 million on it. In total, by 2015, the Canadian government has spent $310 million. So almost half of the money that was invested in the JSF or F-35 warplane program was done by the Liberals. So for them to come out as the big opponents of this particular weapons program is kind of duplicitous. They both gave equal amounts of money to it and were both supportive of this thing. And now for the liberals to say, well, we're going to cancel the deal, you know, I think that's just done for appearance's sake. The liberals like to have the appearance of being and to say whatever they need to say to make people think that they're promoting peace. But in reality, they're just as deeply invested in these things as the conservatives are, it seems. If you actually look at what they do and not just listen to what they say. And it's disappointing that the NDP didn't say they were going to cancel the F-35. And both the Liberals and the NDP said that they would just, here's our step into the another topic where there's curious realities conflicting with perceptions is to do with the whole issue of military spending. So none of the parties in Canada during the election campaign, even the Greens, so the Greens, the NDP, the Liberals, and the Conservatives, all said they would not reduce military spending. Even the Greens, who really, there's no chance that they're going to get elected, they could have easily said that they were going to reduce military spending, but even they wouldn't commit to it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's not surprising that the Liberals wouldn't commit to reducing military spending or that the Conservatives wouldn't commit to that, but the NDP and the Greens?
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me...
Very disappointing.
Yeah, the NDP, I mean, back before the election financing laws, and I actually have a question about that in a minute, but before the election financing laws kicked in, both the Liberals and the Conservatives took money from defense contractors, but the NDP did not.
That's correct. My
impression is that the NDP would ipso facto have a more pacifist kind of foreign policy.
I wouldn't say pacifist.
Maybe,
but,
yeah, you're true, but less militaristic, shall we say.
Well, yeah, one would hope so. But they're not willing to say that they want to reduce military spending. As they get closer to power and they feel that they are able to possibly win an election, they become more and more like the Liberals or the Conservatives. During the period from, well, when I started researching military industry's donations to political party campaigns, election campaigns, was in the 1980s and through the 80s and the 90s. I can't remember when the law changed, but the Liberals changed it so that corporations couldn't give money directly to candidates during election campaigns. But during that 15 or 20 years where I was researching it, I found that the Liberals and Conservatives received about the same amount from over the years from the military companies. The NDP didn't receive money from military companies, but whether that was because they refused to take it or because the companies refused to give it to them because they didn't think that the NDP were going to win. If the NDP were poised to win, then the military companies would start considering them as a party that they might donate to. And when I would conjecture, and also we've seen when the NDP has won in provincial elections, that they are not enemies of military corporations and military export companies. In Nova Scotia, for example, the NDP premier spoke at the opening of a huge arms bazaar there, the largest military trade show export event, and promoted the military industry. And in Manitoba, the NDP government gave, I think it was $50 million. Yeah, it was $50 million, at least one case of $50 million. Maybe they gave more as well to a big military company there that makes missiles and rockets that are attached to helicopters and warplanes. They always say that, and in Ontario, the same sort of thing happened when we had Bob Rae as the premier here, the NDP, they didn't divorce themselves from military industry trade show events. The thing is, the NDP has also been a bit disappointing to certain progressives like myself.
Yeah. You know, I was going to ask you the question about – because we know that in the United States, politicians are financed by these defense contractors, you know, with financial donations for their campaigns. And yeah. I know that used to be the – like I said, it used to be the case in Canada. But a decade ago, we brought in election financing legislation that bans corporations from donating directly to political parties.
And unions as well.
And unions as well. And, you know, so I wanted to ask, you know, what would motivate these political parties to promote the interests of these military industries? And it sounds like what you've been saying is that what I gather from what you're saying is that the closer you are to getting to power, the less incentive you have to criticize some of these entities that are seem sort of part of the power base of the country. Is that kind of where
I would say that. I'd say that's true. That seems to be self-evident. One point that should be made is that although corporations and unions can't give money directly to campaigns anymore, individuals, of course, can. And you know, changing the law didn't really stop these parties from getting money. They still get as much money, more money, really, than they did before. But you know what? It actually, when the Liberals changed that law so that the companies couldn't give money, it actually made it much harder for people like me who had been 15 years or whatever been researching which companies were giving money to the parties. I couldn't do that anymore because the parties weren't listed. The companies were no longer listed. But you know what? The executives from those companies can still give money. So what you've got is it's sort of, in a way, I felt that it kind of disguised what was the continuing donations from the military-industrial complex were disguised or covered up. It made it more difficult for researchers like myself to actually track where the money was coming from, because, you know, you've got a board of directors of some big company, and they don't all have really unusual names. So when you look through the list of donors, I think they listed donors over $1,000. Those were the ones that Elections Canada reported. So if you look at that list of names of donors, you can't necessarily figure out which John Smith it is. Is that the John Smith that's the director of General Motors, or is that John Smith that's my neighbor that, you know, works for he's a custodian at the school or something? You know, you can't it's taken away a tool that we used to have to track where the money was coming from and where it was going.
Do you think that that might have been deliberate, or is that just sort of an interesting happenstance?
I don't know. I think that they wanted to remove money from that was going to the NDP from the labor unions, and maybe they couldn't do that without also removing the money from corporations. I'm not sure what motivated them. I wouldn't be surprised if the Liberals were motivated by the kind of deception that I'm talking about, that occurred as a result of their policy change.
Now, I know that before we started this interview, you spoke to me about something called the Arms Trade Treaty, and
right.
I'm wondering how that intersects with how that's intersecting with the current policies. Could you talk about that a little?
Yeah, sure. So the Arms Trade Treaty is a UN treaty. It's backed by some of the largest international civil society organizations that are involved in development, human rights, and peace issues. Their household names, groups like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, for example. They're huge, and Oxfam is another one. So they're pretty well-known, huge mainstream progressive organizations that support, and many others, hundreds of other smaller groups. Many of them receive money from their governments not all of them, but quite a lot of them do receive financing from their governments. Sometimes, in fact, to do contracts to promote things like the Arms Trade Treaty. So, for example, in Canada, Project Plowshares, which is the largest peace group in Canada, it's mandated by the churches, and it's a pretty prominent. It's the biggest peace group in the country. It's received several hundred thousand dollars from the Canadian government, in fact, during the Harper regime, to promote the Arms Trade Treaty. Although, curiously, the Harper government never signed the treaty. It's one of the few countries in NATO. In fact, it's the only country in NATO that didn't sign the Arms Trade Treaty. So you have this curious situation where, and we have to talk about why it is and come up with our analysis of it. Why is it that the world's largest military producers and exporters are solidly behind a treaty called the Arms Trade Treaty, at the same time as the world's largest peace, development, and human rights groups? So you've got the United States, Britain, Israel, Germany, France, all supporting this treaty. And you've got the largest peace and development human rights groups also supporting the same treaty. Well, the treaty actually only deals with illegal military exports and transfers. It doesn't deal with the bulk of the problem, which is the legal sale of weapons that's happening on a daily basis. So, Canada exports, $4 billion worth of military goods to the United States every year. Well, this Arms Trade Treaty will not have anything to do with that. It will not stop, curb, it won't do a thing to deal with that at all. So the vast majority of the military exports in the world are not going to be touched. The reason that the huge weapons-producing countries support this Arms Trade Treaty is because it is a way of controlling the arms trade in a way that they want to control it. It controls this huge complex, the military-industrial complex and its sales abroad and whatnot. It's a way of controlling that. Controlling it doesn't mean that it's going to stop it or that it's going to curb it or that it's going to reduce it. It just means it's going to control it. So it could be a controlled increase. The treaty very explicitly only deals with illicit or illegal sales of weapons. I'm not saying that I support illegal sales of weapons, not in any way, shape, or form. I don't. But we shouldn't pretend, as some of these large mainstream civil society organizations have very clearly done in their websites and in their documentation about their great work on this Arms Trade Treaty. They make it sound as if they're going to stop. This is going to help stop the arms trade. Well, actually, it's really only stopping a little tiny part of it that is in line with what the imperialist powers that are basically the bulk of the problem. They're helping to control this huge international arms trade in a way that the major arms producers and exporters in the world want them to control it. So it's very interesting problem, because you've got a struggle within peace movements and development movements and human rights movements in different countries. So, for example, the campaign against the arms trade in Britain, which is the largest peace group in the country dealing with the arms trade, it's against the Arms Trade Treaty, and it points out and it criticizes the Arms Trade Treaty in the same way that I have just done. Similarly, in the Netherlands, the largest anti-arms trade group in the Netherlands is also very critical of the Arms Trade Treaty. But then in Canada, you have groups like Plowshares, which is our largest peace group, and the Catholic equivalent, which is Development and Peace. They're both very much in support of the Arms Trade Treaty, and in case of Plowshares, they've actually received hundreds of thousands of dollars from the government to organize discussion groups and workshops and, you know, research on this treaty.
Mm. Yeah, sounds.
So, and I could just, I know I'm going on and on here, but I'll just say that the Liberals, the NDP, and the Greens are all very much in support of the Arms Trade Treaty and raise none of these critical questions about how it could be that the major weapons-producing countries are also supporting the same policy that they are in terms of controlling the arms trade.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
I wonder if you could just touch briefly on something. Is when you talk just about the illegal sale of weapons, I mean, there was a story just a few days ago about the Iraqi government discovering a shipment of arms for the Kurds.
Yeah.
And that's kind of an interesting development there.
That's another very curious story. So what happened was, under the Harper Conservative government, Canada agreed to start transporting weaponry to these Kurdish fighters who are fighting against ISIL or ISIS. And so we were flying weapons into them. I think it started in July of this year. Just a couple, actually it was about, I think it was about 2 weeks ago or 10 days ago anyway, the Liberals were in power at that point. The Iraqi government stopped a Canadian military transport plane, a cargo plane, a C-130, and inspected its cargo and found weapons on board, machine guns, like automatic weapons and semi-automatic weapons and other guns that weren't described, but they gave the names of these kinds of weapons that were being transported. Some of them had silencers. I think there were about 20 of them that had silencers, like silencers on semi-automatic and automatic weapons. And they were being transported, apparently, according to the Canadians, they were transporting these to the Kurds. Or to supporters on the ground in the Kurdish area. So the Iraqi officials, like the government of the country, said these are illegal weapons and these are banned weapons. This is, and they stopped the plane from delivering its weapons, the Canadian plane. They turned it back. It was coming from Kuwait. It was bringing illegal banned weapons into Iraq against the wishes of the Iraqi government. There was also a Swedish plane in the same situation. So it was sent back with its weapon load. So the Iraqi government is stopping Canada from transferring illegal banned weapons into the country. So would that be covered by the Arms Trade Treaty? I guess it would. At least the Iraqis would make that case, but Canada hasn't signed the Arms Trade Treaty. It's very curious. And then when this happened, the Iranian media came out and reported the story, mentioned all the details that I mentioned, plus more than the kinds of weapons, the exact kind of weapons. Oh, curiously, again, to make things a little bit more interesting is that some of these weapons are either Russian-made machine guns, Russian-made automatic weapons with silencers, or they're Iraqi knockoffs of Russian weapons. Wasn't clear which they were, but they're not weapons made by any NATO countries. These are Russian-made. So why is Canada transferring Russian or Iraqi knockoffs of Russian machine guns with silencers to somewhere in Iraq from outside Iraq? Is it makes you wonder, is that so that if they are found in the hands of who, I don't know, but if these weapons ever turn up in somebody's hands, they won't be Canadian-made. Why weren't they using Canadian-made automatic weapons? They're using Russian-made ones. Is that so that the Russians are going to then be accused of putting these weapons in the hands of certain people?
That's,
I don't know.
It's an interesting interesting hypothesis because Canada is part of that whole gang that's trying to target the Russians as being the imperialists and the expansionists and the bullies and so on. So it seems odd that they would be selling these Russian. It certainly speaks to the idea that Canadian policy, military policy, foreign policy is not rooted in principle.
And it's not what it appears, yeah. Mm-hmm. And now, the Iranian media also did their article that exposed this, then listed a huge number of examples of what it said were case examples of U.S.-led coalition forces supporting ISIS and supporting ISIL with weapons, with supplies, dropping them equipment, examples of ISIS forces being found to have NATO-made weapons, and just gave a huge list of examples of ISIS fighters having in their hands NATO equipment, and of U.S.-led coalition forces dropping equipment, weapons, and supplies to ISIS. Now, this is what they're saying. So this, I'll take it with a grain of salt, but we do know from history that the United States has a long tradition of arming fundamentalist jihadists in to be their proxy fighters in wars. I mean, this is an uncontrovertible fact. It's not controversial in any way at all. I mean, bin Laden worked for the CIA, as did a lot of those Mujahideen in Afghanistan. They were trusty foot soldiers for the United States, and there's lots of other examples around the world. Also, you have these jihadists that joined the struggle to oust Gaddafi, and you've got lots of examples of jihadists, fundamentalists, Islamists, that are fighting in the war, in cahoots with the United States. So there's a long history of that. There's no denying it. So when Iran says, here's a huge list of examples of this happening again in Iraq, it fits a pattern. Mm. And then we've got this thing, this case of Canada actually sending these weapons in, and the Iranian media were suggesting, they're insinuating that this may be another case.
Now, I'm wondering, Richard Saunders, about Canada's partnerships, international partnerships. I mean, Canada's a member of NATO. Canada's a member of the Northern Command. I think there's a specific kind of security partnership with Israel. And I'm wondering if these sorts of partnerships somehow bind the hands of Canadian governments, which leads to this increased militaristic role, or maybe it's the other way around. Maybe certain commercial interests are what guide the decision to go into these military partnerships. Is that anything you can comment on?
Well, when you say that, Canada is bound by these, its hands are tied by these agreements and treaties and arrangements like NATO and NORAD and et cetera, the thing is, though, that these are not imposed on us. We've deliberately chosen to join those. We have asked to have our hands tied. The Canadian governments, Liberal and Conservative, have willingly and wittingly joined and supported these U.S.-led military alliances and pacts over the decades. So you can't really blame it on the alliances for you know, like as if they're imposed on us or something. I mean, this is what our government has always wanted. We have the closest working relationship of any country with the United States, like the Canadian-U.S. military closeness, connectedness, the interoperability is second to none. So there's really no, like the liberals and conservatives, the liberals are in no way saying that they would withdraw from any of those things. For example, when the liberals said that they would pull out of the F-35 contract, they did that, I believe, for campaign purposes, to make themselves look as if they're more anti-Harper than the NDP, because they want to get elected. But that doesn't mean they're going to withdraw from a military alliance with the United States, or going to, you know, with reduce military spending. They just said, well, we're going to save money by buying some other kind of weapon system, some other kind of warplane to replace the CF-18. We're just not going to buy the F-35s. We're going to buy some other kind of warplanes to replace these old warplanes that we have that are working to drop bombs in Iraq now. And what we're going to do is we're going to save money, and so what we're going to do is spend it on warships. That's what the liberals said. We're going to spend this extra money that we save. We're just going to save it on. We're going to spend it on warships. And the NDP, you know, they would do the same. They're not going to reduce military spending, so they're going to spend it on other kinds of military equipment. Now, this raises the question of what is the peace movement's role in this? And
yeah,
we have some examples, disturbing examples, I think, from my perspective, and not just me. I mean, a lot of people, radical types like myself, also are very disappointed with progressive civil society groups, peace groups, and whatnot. But come out and basically, like, it's not our role in the peace movement to advise the Canadian government on which kinds of weapons it should buy. Don't buy the F-35s. Just spend the money on refurbishing the CF-18s and buy drones, for example, which was the Rideau Institute's position on this.
That's incredible.
You know, advising the Canadian government on what kind of weapons are the best deal. I remember this woman that I know, she's died now, but she said to me, and this always impacted me, and I still remember it. She said, "We don't want war, even if it only costs 2 cents." message that I got from that is, you know, it was not that we want to get the best deal on our military equipment, and that we don't want to spend money on war, unjust wars around the world, imperial wars. It's not that we're, you know, and I would go even farther than that and say we don't even want this, even if it makes us money, which it does, of course, and that's why they do it. It makes money. It makes lots of money for us, so that's why we do it.
Well, Richard Saunders, I mean, could you expand on that thought? I mean, what has happened to the anti-war movement? Is this just a question of they've made strategic errors? Or, like, why does the anti-war movement seem to pale in comparison to, say, the climate movement? What insights do you have here? Have they been somehow co-opted, or?
Well, it's a really good question. I think it's a central question that we have to deal with, and I've been trying to deal with it the last few years. It's been a major focus for my research, and I'm writing about it. And I have a theory.
Okay.
Okay. So it's very complicated, but I mean, and you have to deal with psychological issues. And you have to deal with social, cultural issues. You have to deal with narratives, the stories. It's easy to say lies and talk about propaganda as if they were lies, but often the best propaganda is propaganda told by people who really believe it. Okay, so in order to carry out huge crimes against peace or crimes against humanity, in order to carry out genocide, in order to conduct wars, to wage wars or slavery or any kind of huge crimes, doing harm to other people, in order to do those crimes, it's not just these things are not just done by a small group of psychopaths. Okay, there's just not a. You need a huge. You need huge institutions. These are institutionalized problems. Now, those institutions are filled with good, well-meaning, decent, honest, sincere people who really believe that what they're doing is helping other people. When in fact, for example, with the residential schools in Canada, I mean, this was genocide, but it was carried out by well-meaning church people who thought they were helping, you know, to advance the civilization, the education of savages, heathens, you know, backward people that needed to be uplifted, and that by depriving them of their language and their religion and their culture and stealing or kidnapping children from their families, they actually believed that they were doing good, most of them. Now, that's not to say that there weren't psychopaths involved in the process. It's just to say that I believe most of the people are actually sincerely believe what they're doing is right. So when I criticize the peace movement for this or that, you know, supporting the Arms Trade Treaty, or another one that is a big problem in the peace movement, I believe, is this whole responsibility to protect doctrine, which is another UN doctrine that is supported by the United States and the world's largest warmongering imperial nations as a way of creating pretexts to wage wars based on humanitarian principles. So they say that they need to go have a military operation to go in there and protect human rights because they're being violated by some dictator or something. But actually, the real reason for the war is some economic reason, and they're going to make billions of dollars out of it. They can't tell people that, so they have to trick people into thinking that they're conducting these wars or this genocide or whatever it is. They have to trick people into thinking that it's being done for humanitarian reasons, because they rely on huge numbers of people to carry out these things, not only to stand by and quietly acquiesce with folded arms and watch the thing happening, but they actually need people to roll up their sleeves and get involved and to actually do it. Okay, so you need the general public on board to give the taxes and to send the children off to war and to quietly go along with it. But you also need them to actively be involved in administering the programs of genocide and mass murder. But people are generally good, so they don't want to do those things. So you need narratives. You need stories to make people believe that what they're doing is right. And the best people to promote those narratives are the progressive activists. So if you get the progressive activists, the huge civil society, supposedly, I'm putting in quotations here, you don't see my little fingers going up, with the non-governmental organizations, which curiously often receive huge amounts of government money. So why they're called non-governmental is a bit curious. But anyway, they support government programs like Responsibility to Protect, the Arms Trade Treaty, or with the case of the residential schools, that was funded by the government, but it was a civil society organization, the churches that were administering the program for the government. They're contractors. So we have a situation where civil society organizations, supposedly non-governmental, are actively administering and running and rationalizing and justifying these huge programs, which fall in line perfectly with what the imperial powers want.
This is the first time I think I've heard anybody try to make that connection between the residential schools and this sort of, I don't know, call it a psychological blind spot when it comes to opposing militarism. But a very compelling one. I was wondering, I wanted to touch on one more thing before we close, and that's the role of like one particularly major military contractor is Lockheed Martin, which is behind the F-35 fighter jets.
Right.
And I also happen to know that Lockheed Martin, they were contracted to provide Stats Canada with software for its employees to process its questionnaires in preparation for the 2011 census. And I guess I'm wondering, because, I mean, this is a company that was profiled extensively in the Bowling for Columbine movie. You do a lot of blood on their hands, you might say. I guess maybe you could maybe help our listeners understand what concerns Canada should have, or Canadians should have, with the Canadian government's partnerships with Lockheed Martin.
Well, yeah, it's the connection with the census is, I must confess, something that I don't know that much about. I mean, I know generally about the topic. I think we do have to be cautious when we're, recruiting or contracting huge war industries to have anything to do with collection of data about people. I guess the contract with Lockheed Martin doesn't involve them actually handling the data, but that doesn't mean that they might not engineer some way to allow themselves to get access to that data. But I think they were just coming up with the programs to process the data, as opposed to actually processing the data. It's just creating the programs. But that said, I mean, I think it is a big issue that we shouldn't give the world's largest arms manufacturer a contract to do something like that. It's the same situation in England, actually. The Lockheed Martin UK, which is a subsidiary of the American contractor, is involved in their census data collection as well, or in the programs. Data capture and processing support services for their Office of National Statistics. So, and it may be also the case that Lockheed Martin is doing that in other countries. I'm not sure. But, I'm more focused on Lockheed Martin's role in the F-35s than I am in their involvement with the census. I think we'd need to be skeptical and curious about watch out for that and not turn a blind eye to it. The whole problem that I was trying to get at, and it may relate to this question about Lockheed Martin and the census, is that people turn a blind eye to things. They'd rather not know, you know, and that's part of our problem. But the concept in law of turning a blind eye or willful ignorance is very key to this whole process. Okay, so you've got it's in Britain. It's called Nelsonian knowledge. It's named after Admiral Nelson, who during some battle, he was blind in one eye, and he held his telescope up to his blind eye and looked through the telescope with his blind eye for a signal that he was receiving by flags. He was in a battle in the early 1800s, and he was supposed to receive this signal to tell him to do something, but he didn't want to do it. And he knew what the signal was going to be, or he had very strong reason to believe that what that signal was going to be, but he didn't want to receive the message. So he turned his blind eye to it. So that's called Nelsonian knowledge in British courts. We talk about blind eye knowledge in our court systems, or willful ignorance. So this is when you know something, or you have a good reason to believe that something is the case, but you do not want to look at it, because if you do, then you will have to deal with the not only the legal repercussions, but when we're talking about the peace movement and all these different campaigns that peace activists and human rights activists are involved with, they don't necessarily want to expose themselves to certain facts that will make them realize that what they're doing is wrong. So, for example, with this responsibility to protect doctrine, which is this pretext for
humanitarian excuses. We're going to rely on the United States to fight humanitarian wars? This is a ludicrous idea. So what you have to do in order to go along with responsibility to protect, you have to turn a blind eye to the fact that the people who are that you're relying on to wage these peace wars for you are people who have been waging wars for centuries, and they don't do that for humanitarian reasons. They do it for economic reasons or geopolitical reasons, and those are the real reasons why they wage those wars. But you want to convince yourself that you need to have this military operation to give the UN the power to authorize or give a seal or stamp of approval. You know, it's like those fair trade stickers that are on coffee or whatever, right? You put this fair trade sticker on it, and it's a good seal of approval so that an activist or progressive, good, well-meaning person can go along with it. So they're going to come up with these little UN stickers. I'm speaking metaphorically, a UN sticker that will you can stick on a war, and then people will feel good about fighting that war, whether it's against Libya or Syria or whoever, Iran or whoever the imperial powers want to go to war with. They want progressive people to go along with it, so they need people to turn a blind eye to the reality of what the real reasons are for the war or the arms trade treaty or the whatever the campaign is, whether it's residential schools. You know, you need to be able to assist people in that psychological process so that they can hide from themselves what's going on. So the one other thing, I know we're running out of time, but one other concept here that's important is the idea of plausible deniability, which is where key bureaucrats or leaders within an institution want to hide from the public their involvement in a crime. So they are knowingly involved in a crime, but they want to keep that hidden from other people in the broader society. So they create sort of walls of so that they can plausibly deny that they knew anything about that crime, even though the crime was going on. Well, I didn't know anything about it. Think Reagan and Bush and the Contras and the drug smuggling and etc. with the Contras. It's the same principle, the same process can be applied on an individual level so that you can plausibly deny to yourself that you had any knowledge of that was contrary or contradicting what you're doing. So you're promoting a war to help these poor people that are being oppressed by the dictator, but you have to be able to plausibly deny to yourself that there's a problem with this by not looking at, not recognizing, or not dealing with the fact that you're relying on the world's largest imperial powers to fight your war. So you have to kind of push that aside and not look at it and not think about it. And when people raise it, you kind of have to keep looking away from it because you don't want to look at that because it's making you feel bad for, and it might stop you from doing this thing. And if you're in a career path that depends on doing a certain course of action, then that makes it even harder to withdraw your support from something that you're so deeply invested in.
Okay. Well, Richard Saunders has very interesting insights as always. I think we have to close it there. But thank you. Thank you so much for sharing those thoughts with us and that analysis. And we look forward to future conversations.
Well, thanks. And I hope that what I've said might be useful to people. And when they see certain things happening around them, they might remember what some of the things I said and they might look at things a different way.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Richard Saunders is coordinator of the Coalition to Oppose the Arms Trade and editor of its magazine Press for Conversion. His website is coat.ncf.ca.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour.
You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.